The Social Sharia. Man by nature likes to live in a community. The reason that the Almighty has bestowed him with this nature is that he does not create human beings in the prime of their youth. Similarly, human beings do not generally die in their youth without passing through old age. On the contrary, a human being is created as a feeble child in the womb of the mother who enters this world to be welcomed by her loving affection. He then grows being nurtured and nourished by others. At first, he drags himself and then crawls along his knees before he is able to stand on his feet. Even after this state, he needs the help of others at every step. Finally, after going through various phases of childhood and adolescence, he enters the prime of his youth at the age of 15 or 16. This blooming period of life also does not last more than 20 to 30 years. Then comes old age, and in spite of many a time attaining great heights in intellect in his prime, he once again has to turn to others to fulfill his needs like a frail child for the rest of his life. This life cycle of man necessarily entails that he live in a social setup. From the very beginning of his life, this affinity towards a social setup is fully found in his being. He does not need to find this tendency in his external world. When he enters this world, he brings with him all his internal urges and inner motivations and uses them to fulfill his needs wherever and whenever required. The history of mankind shows that owing to this very aspect of human nature, Adam, the founder of the human dynasty, was not sent alone in this world. He was blessed with a wife from his own species, someone who was meant to be his companion. From these two sprang many men and women as their progeny. Gradually, a family, a tribe, and finally a state came into existence. The resultant social setup afforded man the opportunity to realize his hidden potentials and urges. While pointing out this fact, the Quran says, "Mankind, fear your Lord, who created you from a single person, created of like species his mate, and from these two scattered countless men and women in this world, and fear Allah through whom you seek mutual help, and fear breaking blood relationships. Indeed, God is watching over you." Chapter 4, verse 1. A little deliberation shows that this verse embodies all the principles upon which the Almighty has based human society. Imam Amin Hassan Islahi, while pointing out these principles, writes, "Firstly, this world is not unattended. On the contrary, it has been created by the Almighty who is the Lord of everyone. It is therefore unseemly for a person to create disorder in it and defy his authority. Everyone should remain fearful of the Almighty's grasp, the Almighty who is the creator and master of everyone. Secondly, the Almighty has created man from a single soul, Adam. Consequently, mankind is the progeny of one father. No one is superior to the other. Whatever their color, caste, or creed, all human beings are equal. Indeed, superiority rests on virtues a person acquires through self-effort. All other standards of superiority are baseless. Thirdly, just as mankind is the progeny of one father, their mother is also one, Eve. Hence, no one is superior to the other. One father and mother have created this global family. It is evident from the verse that Eve is of the same species as Adam. This further means that women are not inferior beings. As human beings, men and women are equal in status. Fourthly, the basis of mutual help and cooperation in a society are three driving forces: oneness of God, unity of ancestors, and commonality of blood relationships. It is essential that every person realize the obligation these blood relationships entail and fulfill it. It is also his responsibility to safeguard these relationships and be on guard that no slogan should be able to destroy these blood relationships and replace it with some sentiment of the age of ignorance. If such a thing emerges in a society, it should ring an alarm for the whole society, and it is the duty of every sensitive member of the society to do his utmost to impede its progress. The words, "and fear Allah through whom you seek mutual help and fear breaking blood relationships," at the end of the verse sound this warning. Hence, according to Islam, it is these pillars on which stands the whole edifice of family, society, and state. As long as these pillars are intact, this edifice is intact. If these become weak, the edifice would be endangered, and if they are raised down, the edifice too would be demolished. Reference Amin Hassan Islahi, Tazkiya Nafs, pages 142 to 143. In order to firmly establish a society on these fundamentals, an everlasting bond between the spouses is made essential in the religion of the prophets. The Almighty has informed us that to fulfill this scheme, both a man and a woman are innately equipped with all the necessary urges, so that they are able to become true companions of one another and live as two souls united in one body. And among his signs is that he created for you mates from among your species, that you may obtain comfort from them. And for this purpose, he has put love and sympathy within you. Surely, in this are signs for those who reflect. Chapter 30, verse 21. If the whole life of a human being, from childhood to old age, is kept in consideration, sense and reason endorse that to fulfill his physical, psychological, and social needs, an everlasting marriage bond between the spouses is essential. Consequently, the Almighty has given a detailed social law to man through his prophets regarding the society which is established on this basis. In the following paragraphs, an attempt shall be made to explain this law enshrined in the Quran and Sunnah as the eternal Sharia of God. Nikah, or marriage. And marry those among you who are single, and those who have the capability for marriage among your slaves, male or female. If they are poor, Allah will give them means out of His grace. For Allah is ample giving, and He knows all things. And let those who find not an opportunity for marriage keep themselves chaste, until Allah gives them means out of His grace. Surah chapter 24, verses 32-33. It is asserted with great stress and clarity that in the eyes of the Almighty, there is only one legitimate way to satisfy one's sexual desire from women, marriage, or nikah. If marriage is somehow not possible, then this cannot become a license for gratifying one's sexual desire without entering into the marital bond. Consequently, the society is urged to wed people who as yet have not been able to marry. Marriage is an open declaration of a contract by a man and woman to live permanently as husband and wife. It is declared in the presence of people, through a responsible personality, with great solemnity and gravity, after he delivers a sermon, to counsel and guide them. It is evident from divine scriptures that this way was adopted from the very birth of man on this earth. Consequently, the Quran was not required to give a new directive in this regard. As an age-old sunnah of the prophets, Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam passed it on to his ummah, thus keeping it intact. In the above-quoted verses, besides urging people to follow this practice, they are given glad tidings that even if they are poor, they should marry in order to protect themselves from immoral acts. Hopefully, the Almighty will bless them with resources if they resolve to follow this practice. Imam Amin Hassan Islahi, while commenting on this verse, writes, "As long as a person does not have a wife, his life is more like a nomad and many of his abilities remain shrunk and dormant. Similarly, as long as a woman is unmarried, she resembles a creeper which is not able to grow and flourish owing to want of support. But once a woman has a husband and a man has a wife, their abilities develop and increase, and when both of them start to strive in life together, the Almighty blesses them in their struggle and their circumstances also change for the better." Reference Amin Hassan Islahi, Tadabburi Quran, Volume 5, page 400. Relationships prohibited for marriage. And marry not women whom your fathers married, except what has been done in the past. It was shameful and odious, an abominable practice indeed. Prohibited to you for marriage are your mothers, your daughters, your sisters, your maternal and paternal aunts, the daughters of your brothers and sisters, your mothers who have suckled you, and your sisters through fosterage. Similarly, the mothers of your wives, your stepdaughters raised under you born of your wives with whom you have lain. No offense if you have not lain with their mothers, and the wives of your real sons, and two sisters in wedlock at the same time, except for what has already happened. God indeed is oft forgiving, most merciful. Also prohibited are women already married, except those whom your right hands possess. This is a written obligation upon you from God. Chapter 4, verses 22-24. The above quoted verse enlists women with whom marriage has been prohibited. The list begins with the stepmother and ends with women who are married to someone. In between these two, the prohibited women mentioned are based on the three bases of relationship: lineage, fosterage, and marriage. In certain sections of the Arab Jahiliyyah, there was a tradition according to which a son inherited the wife of his father, and he would feel nothing wrong with inheriting her. The Quran refers to it as open lewdness and a shameful and an abominable practice. Consequently, it prohibited this practice and declared that whatever happened in the past shall be overlooked, but in the future, no Muslim should perpetrate such an indecent act. Similar is the case of the woman who is married to someone. No person has the right to marry her unless she is legally divorced from her husband. It is obvious that such a practice totally negates the very reason for which the institution of family has been set up. Consequently, it has been prohibited by the Almighty. However, women of those times who were made captives in battles were exempted from this rule. For them, the rule was that if they wanted to marry, then, in spite of being already married, could marry. This was because as soon as they married anew, their previous marriage stood annulled automatically as per the traditions of those times. The words in the Quran show that it has also approved this exception so that if such women wanted to become part of the Muslim society, they could easily do so. The matter of the remaining prohibitions shall now be taken up. Relationships by lineage. The verse first of all mentions the seven relations prohibited because of lineage, such as mothers, daughters, sisters, maternal aunts, and the daughters of the brothers and daughters of the sisters, or nieces. These seven relations possess such sanctity that people of noble nature cannot even think of any sexual inclination towards them. There is no doubt that it is this sanctity which is the foundation of civilization, the spirit of culture, and the fountainhead of pure and unadulterated sentiments of affection and gentleness that bring a family into being. The Almighty wants the gaze of a son for his mother, of a father for his daughter, of a brother for his sister, of a nephew for both his maternal and paternal aunts, of a maternal and a paternal uncle for their nieces, to remain free from the slightest trace of sexual leaning. Sense and reason also bear witness that any sort of sexual proclivity between these relations is devastating for human dignity and honor, and is totally against the unadulterated state of chastity and purity that distinguishes man from animals. The directive stated in the given verses regarding these relations is very explicit. However, three aspects about this directive should remain clear. Firstly, the words used for these relations in Arabic entail that no distinction be made between real and step relations. Consequently, both a real mother and a stepmother, a real sister and a half-sister, for example, would equally be the addressees of this directive. Similar is the case for the real or half-sister of a father and a mother. Likewise is the case of the daughters of brothers and sisters. Whether they are real or half, their daughters will be regarded as addressees of this directive. Secondly, the word mother also connotes the father's mother and the mother's mother all the way up. Likewise, the word daughter also includes the son's daughter and the daughter's daughter all the way down. No discrimination can be made between them regarding this directive. Thirdly, the sister of the maternal grandfather and the sister of the paternal grandmother are like paternal and maternal aunts respectively. Hence, they shall also be included on equal basis in the application of the directive. Foster relationships have a similar sanctity as the real ones. While commenting on this aspect, Imam Amin Ihsan Islahi writes, "In our society, people do not consider foster relationships as strong as what the Arabs considered them to be. This is because of the difference in customs between their society and ours. The truth of the matter is that this relationship has deep resemblance with a maternal relationship. A mother who suckles and brings up a child is his half-mother, if not a full one. Moreover, how is it possible that a child not be influenced by someone whose milk has nourished and sustained him? An absence of such influence would mean that his nature has been perverted, and it was necessary for a religion like Islam, which conforms to human nature, to reform such perversion." Reference Amin Ihsan Islahi, Tadabburi Quran, Volume 2, page 275. While explaining how exactly a foster relationship is formed, Imam Amin Ihsan Islahi writes, "Such a relationship is not formed by some chance episode of suckling a child. The words of the Quran stated in this verse clearly testify that this relationship is established only with the full intent of those involved. In other words, an accidental happening does not establish this relationship. It only comes into being after it is planned and is well thought of. Consequently, in the first place, the words used by the Quran are your mothers who have suckled you. Secondly, the word rada'a is used. People conversant with the subtleties of the Arabic language know that irda is from the ifal category, which in general has an element of emphasis in it. Moreover, the word rada'a is absolutely inappropriate to be used when a lady suckles a crying child to soothe him. The Prophet ﷺ has also explained the above purport of the Quran in the following words. Aisha radiallahu ta'ala anhu narrates from the Prophet ﷺ, if one or two drops are drunk by chance, then this does not prohibit a relationship. Aisha radiallahu ta'ala anhu narrates, once when the Prophet ﷺ came over to my house, a person was sitting there. He disliked the situation and I could see a feeling of disgust on his face. I said, O Messenger of God, this is my foster brother. The Prophet ﷺ replied, be careful regarding all such brothers because a foster relationship is only established at the time when a child is suckled in the age when he needs milk. Here, no one should misconceive the case of Salim, the adopted son of Abu Hudhaifa radiallahu ta'ala anhu, who was suckled in mature age. What at most can be said about this case was that the Prophet ﷺ had suggested a way to deal with the situation that had arisen and after the newly revealed directive of the Quran regarding adopted children. It cannot be made the basis of a permanent directive. The case of Salim is thus. So Sahla, who was the wife of Abu Hudhaifa radiallahu ta'ala anhu, and the daughter of Suhail ibn Amr al-Karshi al-Amiri, once came to the Prophet ﷺ and said, O Messenger of God, we always considered Salim as our son. He used to live with me and with Abu Hudhaifa in the same house and would see me in my house clothes. You are well aware of the directive which the Almighty has revealed about such boys. Now, what is your opinion regarding this matter? The Prophet ﷺ replied, feed him with your milk. Reference Abu Dawud, Sunan, Volume 2, page 229, number 2061. Hence, it is absolutely certain that for fosterage, it is essential that the child be in the suckling age, and that the matter be a planned one and not an accidental one. Moreover, foster relations are prohibited for marriage, just as the ones through lineage are. This is the very purport of the Quran. However, the style in which this directive is stated, peculiar to the sublime language of the Quran, is such that what is self-evident because of intrinsic evidence or because of some logical outcome is not stated in words. The words used are, your mothers who have suckled you and your sisters through fosterage. As stated, together with foster mothers, foster sisters are also regarded as relations prohibited for marriage. Had the directive ended with foster mothers, nothing further could have been understood from it. However, if the relationship of fosterage with a mother makes her daughter a foster sister, then it is but logical to regard other relations of the foster mother to be also included in this directive. If being suckled through the same mother can make a girl a foster sister, why can't the sister of the foster mother be regarded as the maternal aunt, her husband as the father, the sister of her husband as the paternal aunt, her daughter's daughter and her son's daughter as nieces? Hence, it is obvious that all these relations are also prohibited in marriage. This indeed is the purport of the Book of God, and the words testify to it. It is evident to any person of knowledge who deliberates on these words. The Prophet ﷺ is reported to have said, every relationship which is prohibited for marriage owing to lineage is also prohibited owing to fosterage. Relationships by marriage. After a mention of relationships prohibited for marriage on the basis of lineage and fosterage, relationships which are prohibited for marriage on the basis of marriage itself are mentioned in the verse quoted earlier. Such is the obviousness of the sanctity of these relationships in human nature that no reasoning is required. Consequently, the daughter-in-law is prohibited for the father, and the mother-in-law, the wife's daughter, the wife's sister, and both nieces of the wife, the maternal and paternal aunts of the wife, are all prohibited for the husband. However, since these relationships are formed through the husband and the wife, a degree of weakness is found in them. Owing to this reason, the Quran has imposed the following three conditions on the prohibition of these relationships. Firstly, only the daughter of that wife is prohibited with whom one has had conjugal contact. Secondly, only the daughter-in-law of a real son is prohibited. Thirdly, the sister of a wife, her maternal and paternal aunts, and her two nieces are only prohibited if the wife is in wedlock with the husband. The first of the above-mentioned conditions is referred to in the Quran in these words: Your stepdaughters raised under you, born of your wives with whom you have lain. No offense if you have not lain with their mothers. Here, together with the condition of conjugal contact, it is also said that stepdaughters who are raised under the guardianship of the husbands. It is evident that this last qualification is not a condition. While explaining this aspect, Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, In the Arabic language, not every attribute is meant to impose a condition, such that if the attribute does not exist, the directive would stand null and void. Intrinsic evidence and the context of the verse shows which attributes signify a condition and which merely portray a situation. In this particular instance, it is not only the context and intrinsic evidence, but explicit words which testify that the daughter of a wife is only prohibited if the husband has had conjugal contact with the wife. It is thus evident that the real reason of prohibition for such a daughter is conjugal contact with her mother. If this is the case, then the husband cannot marry such a daughter, whether she has been raised under his guardianship or not. It must be kept in consideration that in lofty classical Arabic, especially that of the Quran, a negation after a positive assertion, or vice versa, are never without purpose. They are indeed very meaningful. Mostly, such a style is meant to remove ambiguity from a statement. Hence, the view of some people that marriage with only that daughter of a wife, with whom conjugal contact is made, is forbidden, who is raised by the husband, is incorrect. In their opinion, if this is not the case, then marriage is allowed. The second condition stated in the verse is mentioned by the words, And the wives of your real sons. The reason for this condition of real sons is that in the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, people would consider marriage with the wives of the adopted sons as prohibited. By imposing this condition, the Quran has elucidated the fact that mere adoption does not give the child the status of a begotten child, nor does this adoption entail any prohibition regarding marriage. In Surah Azab, the words of the Quran are, And he has not made your adopted sons your real sons. Such is your speech by your mouths, and Allah says the truth, and only He shows the right way. Call them after the names of their fathers. That is more just in the sight of Allah. But if you know not their fathers, then they are your brothers in faith and your friends. Chapter 33, verses 4 to 5. The third condition is stated in the words, And two sisters in wedlock at the same time. A little deliberation shows that this expression is of the same style as the one which has been discussed before under foster relationships. Although the Quran has only stated the prohibition of two sisters in simultaneous wedlock, it is evident that if combining two sisters in wedlock is a lewd thing as far as the relationship of marriage is concerned, then combining a lady with her brother's daughter in wedlock or with her sister's daughter in wedlock is like combining a mother and a daughter in wedlock. Hence, despite the words used, the purport of the Quran undoubtedly is, and two sisters in wedlock at the same time, and a lady with her brother's daughter at the same time, and a lady with her sister's daughter at the same time. However, all these words are suppressed because what is mentioned points towards the suppression as obviously understood. So obvious are the words of the suppression that no student of the Quran can err in understanding them. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam consequently is reported to have said, Neither can a lady and her paternal aunt, nor can a lady and her maternal aunt, be combined in wedlock. Reference Malik ibn Anas al-Muwatta, page 341, number 1600. Bounds and conditions of nikah, or marriage. And all other women, except for those specified, are lawful to you, such that you seek them through your wealth, desiring chastity, not lust. Consequently, if you have not paid their dowers as yet, pay them their dowers as your obligation for the benefit you have derived from them. If after a dower is prescribed, you agree mutually on something, there is no blame on you, and Allah is all-knowing, all-wise. Chapter 4, verse 24. The bounds and conditions of nikah which this verse outlines are, First, a nikah should be conducted through wealth, which here refers to the dower. The Quran emphasizes that the Almighty has ordained this payment as an essential prerequisite of marriage. Consequently, it has directed Muslims to immediately complete this obligation if they have not yet done so. However, once a dower has been ascertained, with the realization that it is an obligation of a Muslim husband, he and his wife can mutually change its amount as well as the time of its payment. Everyone must nevertheless know that the originator of this law is all-knowing and all-wise. All his directives are based on flawless knowledge and deep wisdom. Hence, neither should anyone attempt to disobey it, nor dare change it in any way. What is the significance of this dower? When a man and a woman pledge to marry, it is the man who takes the financial responsibility of the woman he is bringing home. The dower is nothing but a symbolic expression of his responsibility. The Quran uses the word sadaqah, an ajr for it. Both words imply money which is given to a wife for her needs in return for her companionship. Like nikah and the nikah sermon, dower payment is an ancient practice that was in vogue in Arabia before the advent of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. It is mentioned in the Bible in similar terms. While commenting upon the importance of this age-old custom, Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, "Matters in which payment of money is a precondition, and the payment itself is not a favor, but a duty, such that it is understood, even though it may not be mentioned, and its payment is an obligation, dependent on the social status of the lady. Then such matters are serious ones, both as regards the sharia and the norms of society. No sensible person will become party to such a contract unless, after deep consideration, he prepares himself to fulfill its responsibilities. It is for these benefits that the payment of the dower has been made essential. Those who have overlooked these benefits deem that the payment of the dower money has relegated the status of a woman to a saleable commodity. This, of course, is the result of not properly perceiving the underlying reason for the payment of the dower. The reason for this payment is to sound a warning to every person seeking to enter the sacred bond of marriage that he must think over the extent of responsibility that this step will entail. Marital matters must be taken seriously. Even words said in a light-hearted manner in such matters have a solemn status. It is like walking on a sharp-edged sword." Reference Amin Hassan Islahi, Tadabbari Quran, Volume 2, page 278. The Sharia has not fixed any amount for the dower. It has been left to the norms and traditions of a society and to the discretion of the people. Consequently, it can be fixed to any amount which is in accordance with the social status of the woman and the financial status of the man who is to become her husband. The second requisite of marriage stated in the verse is chastity. No adulterer has the right to marry a chaste woman, and no adulteress has the right to marry a chaste man, except if the matter has not gone to court and the two purify themselves of this sin by sincere repentance. The words in the Quran point to this prerequisite. At another place, the Quran says, "The man guilty of fornication may only marry a woman similarly guilty or an idolatress, and the woman guilty of fornication may only marry such a man or an idolater. The believers are forbidden such marriages." Chapter 24, verse 3. It is obvious from this verse and also evident from divine scriptures that fornication and polytheism are exactly similar to one another. Just as it cannot be acceptable in any way that a husband or wife commit marital unfaithfulness, similarly, it is totally unacceptable for a Muslim that someone else besides the Almighty be worshipped in his house. In fact, this is more detestable a sin than sleeping with some other woman. This similarity between fornication and polytheism could have been deduced. However, the following Quranic verse explicitly states it, "And wed not idolatrous women, unless they embrace faith. And remember, a believing slave girl is better than an idolatrous woman, although you may fancy her. And wed not your women to the idolaters, unless they embrace faith. And remember, a believing slave is better than an idolater, although you may fancy him." Surah 2, verse 221. The Jews and Christians of the Prophet's time were also deeply incriminated with the filth of polytheism, both in their beliefs and in their deeds. However, since they were basically monotheists, the Almighty was lenient enough to Muslims to allow marriage with their chaste women. "And lawful to you in marriage are also chaste women from among these people of the book, before you when you give them their dowers with the condition that you desire chastity, not lewdness, nor becoming secret paramours." Surah 5 verse 5. It is evident from the context of the above verse that this permission was granted when no confusion remained regarding Tawheed or monotheism, and it prevailed over the polytheistic Arab society in every manner. It should be kept in mind that the verse quoted above begins with the word, this day. This word shows that the permission given was also very much dependent on the circumstances of those times. It was expected that if Muslim men would marry among the people of the book, these women would be positively influenced by Islam. In this way, not only would there be no clash between monotheism and polytheism, but also there was a great chance that most of them, consequently, Muslims today must necessarily take this aspect into consideration if they want to benefit from this permission. Similarly, it should be kept in mind that it is essential for the sanctity of the institution of family, the very institution marriage creates, that marriage takes place with the consent and presence of the elders of the family. There is no doubt about the fact that the decision of marriage is primarily taken by the concerned man and woman. However, if the marriage does not take place through the consent of the guardians or the elders of a family, then there must be a solid reason for this. In the absence of such a reason, a state has the authority to stop such a marriage from taking place. Narratives such as, "No marriage shall take place without the permission of the guardian," and other similar ones actually allude to this aspect. Since the rebellion of a lady in this matter can cause great disruption in a family, the Prophet ﷺ made it clear upon the guardians through both his words and the measures he took that they must not take any decision in this regard without her consent. If the lady wants, their decision can be revoked. It is narrated by Abu Huraira radiallahu ta'ala anhu that the Prophet ﷺ is reported to have said, "A widow must not be married off without her consent, and the consent of a virgin is also necessary." People inquired, "How should her consent be obtained?" The Prophet answered, "If she stays quiet, it means that she agrees to it." Ibn Abbas narrates from the Prophet ﷺ, "A widow can take her decision herself, and permission must be sought from a virgin." Binti Khudam says that when she became a widow, her father solemnized her marriage. She did not like the decision, so she came over to the Prophet ﷺ and he gave her the permission to revoke her marriage. Reference Al-Bukhari Al-Jamil Sahih, page 919, number 5138. Rights and Obligations of the Spouses. Men are the guardians of women, because God has given the one more preference over the other, and because they financially support them. Consequently, pious women are obedient to their husbands and keep their secrets, for Allah also keeps secrets. And as for those whom you fear rebellion, admonish them first, and next, refuse to share their beds, and even then if they do not listen, punish them. Then if they obey you, take no further action against them. Indeed, Allah is exalted and mighty. Surah 4 verse 34. In the verses preceding the above quoted verse, the Almighty has made it clear that the real sphere in which one should strive in outdoing others is not the sphere of inborn abilities and characteristics, because in this sphere some in reality hold preference over others. The Almighty has created some special people superior to others as regards their mental, physical, economic, and social status. Similar is the case between a man and a woman. They have been created as counterparts such that one is by nature the active member and the other the passive one. While the former trait needs domination, vigor, and force, the latter needs gentleness, subtlety, and acquiescence. Viewed thus, each possesses relative superiority to the other. These are inborn characteristics, and any effort to surpass one another in this area would be tantamount to waging war against nature. This would, of course, only leave them to mourn their own misfortune. The Almighty has pointed out that in contrast to this sphere, there is another sphere in which people should strive to outdo one another. This is the sphere of earning reward for oneself through good deeds, high character, and virtue. The Quran at various places has referred to this sphere by the comprehensive words, faith and righteous deeds. There is no restriction on anyone in striving to outdo others in this sphere. In fact, trying to surpass others in this sphere is as desirable as it is condemnable in the sphere of innate abilities. Both a man and a woman will earn great reward if they strive and exert themselves in this area. It is open for every person, whether a bondsman or a free man, a person of high social status or low, good-looking or ugly, blind or blessed with the faculty of sight. If a person does want to become superior to others, it is this fear that he should select for all his efforts and endeavors. Wasting one's effort in the wrong sphere only brings into existence clashes and disputes which are of no avail. Consequently, if he really wants to test his mettle and expend his energies, he must select the sphere of piety and virtue. The Quran says, "And in no way covet those things in which God has bestowed his favors on some of you than on others. To men it is allotted what they earn, and to women what they earn. And ask God of his bounty, for God has full knowledge of all things." Surah 4 verse 32. This verse pinpoints the above stated premise as the guiding principle in the organization of a family setup. A family is like a small state. Just as every state requires a ruler for its establishment and survival, this small state also requires someone to take charge of its helm. Either the husband could have been bestowed with this responsibility, or the wife. The Quran informs us that the husbands have been entrusted with this responsibility. An expression has been used by the Quran to convey this purport. In Arabic, when a preposition is used after a verb, the meanings of protection and financial responsibility are incorporated in the verb. This, in other words, refers to heading a family, and all these things are mutually essential. The Quran has given two reasons for this choice. While explaining these reasons, Imam Amin Asan Islahi writes, "First, men have been granted superiority over women. There are certain innate abilities and traits in men which are more pronounced in him, and because of which he has been made the head of a family unit. For example, a man is much more gifted innately to protect and to defend himself and to earn livelihood and to take the initiative than a woman." It should be appreciated here that the superiority men have over women is not absolute. It is only in certain spheres which entitle men to become head of the family unit. There are certain other spheres in which women are more superior to men, but they do not entitle them to become the head of family. For example, a man does not have the extent of ability a woman has to take care of household affairs and to look after children. That is why the superiority which is mentioned in the verse is alluded to in an implicit manner, such that it can be concluded that both men and women are superior to one another in different spheres. However, a man is superior to a woman as far as becoming the head of family is concerned. Second, a husband bears financial responsibility for the wife. It is his obligation to earn and fulfill the needs of his wife and children. Obviously, this responsibility has not been assumed as a coincidence or as a favor, but because of the fact that only he is fully capable of doing so. He only has this ability, and only he can fulfill its rights. After declaring that the husband should head a family, the Quran goes on to point out certain things to the wife for the smooth functioning of the institution of family. They are: wives should be obedient and adaptable to their husbands. They should keep the secrets of their husbands and protect their honor and integrity. The first of these things does not require elaboration. Without obedience and adjustment, no system can work, whether it be a state or any other institution. This is the natural requirement of any system. In the absence of these attitudes, no system can function and will ultimately disintegrate by giving way to indiscipline and anarchy. An expression has been adopted for the second of these things. Generally, this expression has been taken to imply guarding in absentia. This writer has taken it to imply keeping of secrets, as this, in his opinion, is the correct connotation of the expression. While explaining the meaning of this expression, Imam Amin Asan Islahi writes, "One reason for adopting this meaning is that the word is very commonly used to imply secrets. Second, here the nature of the expression is such that it cannot be taken to mean guarding in absentia. Third, guarding of secrets is one of the most important issues between a husband and wife. They are the natural protectors of one another in this regard. The position of the wife is more important in this regard. She has full knowledge of her husband's weaknesses and strengths. She is well aware of what ensues in the house, as well as full knowledge of the extent and nature of her husband's wealth and property. His honor and integrity rest with her. If she decides to reveal all his secrets, she can totally disgrace him. For this reason, the Quran has specially mentioned this attribute of a wife. The addition of some words is very meaningful and refers to the exalted status of this attribute. It is in fact a manifestation of a divine attribute in man. The Almighty also keeps secrets of his creatures. If he starts revealing these secrets, everyone would be totally humiliated. Thus, the above verse outlines the attitudes of pious wives. As the natural outcome of this directive, wives who adopt a rebellious attitude or reveal household secrets are not pious in the eyes of the Almighty. However, if a wife becomes rebellious, can a husband punish her? The Quran has replied to this question in the affirmative. The verse refers to the rebellion of a wife by the word, which literally means to defy authority. However, it is predominantly used for the utter defiance of authority a wife shows to the husband. Obviously, the word is not used for a blemish or for an instance of indifference by the wife. Similarly, it does not imply that a wife cannot express her opinion, taste, or the various traits of her personality. It implies the behavior which a wife adopts when she seems inclined to challenge the authority of the husband and disrupt the discipline of the house. If the situation reaches this extent, the Almighty has given the husband three options. First, he should urge his wife to mend her ways. The words used by the Quran mean that she can be admonished and also scolded to some extent in this regard. Second, intimate marital relations with her should be suspended in order to communicate to her that if she does not mend her ways, there would be other repercussions, similar to those a teacher gives to a student. It is evident from the style of the verse that a gradual sequence should be adopted in exercising these options. In other words, the second step after the first should only be adopted if the husband is convinced that there is no other option but to go on to the next step. These measures point to the utmost limit to which a husband can go regarding admonishing his wife. The Quran says that if the wife mends her ways, through these measures a husband should not look for revenge and vengeance. He is warned thus, "Indeed God is exalted and mighty." The implication is that if the Lord of the heavens and the earth forgoes the arrogance of his creatures and forgives them, if they repent, his creatures should also not misuse their authority over others. Believers, you are forbidden to forcibly inherit women, nor by treating them with harshness may you take away part of what you have given them, except where they have been guilty of open lewdness, and live with them befittingly. Because if you dislike them, it may that you dislike a thing, and Allah brings about through it a great deal of good. Surah 4 verse 19. These verses mention the rights of women and instruct the society regarding the correct behavior to be adopted with them. The first thing pointed out is that women are not assets or animals which a person may inherit and then use them the way he likes. They too are human beings who have an independent personality. They are given free will which they can fully exercise in the limits set forth by the Almighty. The background of giving this directive is that in certain sections of pre-Islamic Arabia, the wives of a person were also transferred to his heirs like his wealth and the animals would be. And if he had sons, they would even establish sexual relations with these stepmothers without any hesitation. The Quran sought to put an end to this ignominious custom and stressed that women are fully free to make their decisions. Nothing can be imposed upon them without their consent. The second thing stressed here is that even if a believer dislikes his wife, he should not subject her to harsh treatment in order to recover any wealth or property that he has gifted her. Such an attitude can only be accepted if the wife is guilty of open sexual transgression. If the wife is not guilty of such behavior and is living as a faithful and obedient lady leading a virtuous life, it is totally against justice and decency for the husband to harass her merely because he dislikes her. No doubt if a wife shows moral misconduct, then this is a detestable thing. But no husband is allowed to deprive her of a decent living because he does not like her looks or because her temperament is different from his. The third thing emphasized here is that a husband who does not like his wife should not deal with her in accordance with the norms of justice and equity, graciousness, and decency, to which his own nature testifies. The words used in the verse to convey this meaning imply good intentions and traditions of a society. In other words, the Quran instructs a husband to adopt a befitting attitude with his wife in accordance with the good traditions of the society whether he likes her or not. He is told that if he treats her nicely in spite of his aversion to her, he might win the blessings of the Almighty both in this world and in the hereafter. While explaining the words used to convey the above-mentioned meaning, Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, "Although the word used here in Arabic implies hope and expectation, those who are aware of the delicacies of the language know that when used on occasions such as this, it implies a promise from the Almighty. This reference points to the fact that those who give priority to higher human traits and values instead of appearance are promised great rewards from the Almighty for this sacrifice. Those who have actually embarked upon this track have borne witness to the veracity of this fact. And none other than God is the most truthful." Amin Hassan Islahi, Tadabburi Quran, Volume 2, page 270. It is obvious from the above discussion that if a husband is required to behave decently, even if he dislikes the wife, he is all the more required to be decent when there is no cause for this dislike. A wrong attitude in this regard would earn great displeasure of the Almighty. In the sermon of the last Hajj, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam is reported to have said, "Indeed, you have rights over women, and they also have rights over you. You have the right that they neither permit into your homes nor sleep with anyone you dislike. Listen, their right upon you is that you feed and clothe them in the best way you are able to." Reference Ibn Majah, Sunan, Volume 2, page 417, number 1851. Polygamy. "And if you fear that you shall not be able to deal justly with the orphans, marry their mothers who are lawful to you. 223344. But if you fear that you shall not be able to deal justly with them, then only one, or those which your right hands possess. That will be more suitable to prevent you from doing injustice. And give these women their dowers also the way dowers are given. But if they, of their own good pleasure, remit any part of it to you, take it and consume it gladly." Surah 4, verses 3-4. The addressees of the above quoted verses are the guardians of the orphans. They are directed to marry the mothers of the orphans who are lawful to them if they fear that they would not be able to do justice to the onerous responsibility of protecting the rights of the orphans and taking care of their wealth and property. In other words, if they decide that if the mothers of the orphans share with them this responsibility, they would be able to discharge it in a better way, they should go ahead and marry them. The reason is that the extent to which mothers are attached to their orphan children, no other person can ever be. It is evident from this explanation that the above quoted verses were not primarily revealed to state any directive regarding polygamy. They were actually revealed to make use of the pre-existing practice of polygamy in Arabia for the welfare of the orphans. At other places, the Quran has clearly alluded to the fact that as per the norms of human nature, the real benefits and advantages of the institution of family manifest themselves in a monogamous family. Consequently, it is stated in various verses that the father of mankind, Adam, radiallahu ta'ala anhu, was blessed with one wife. It is basically social, psychological, political, and cultural needs from which arose the need for polygamy. Such needs existed in various societies to different extents. To cater for these very needs, the Almighty never forbade this practice in the Sharia He gave in various periods of time. Here, in these verses, Muslims are directed to make use of this practice to solve a social problem that had arisen in the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. However, it has been made conditional upon two things. First, even for as noble and objective as the welfare of orphans, a person cannot marry more than four wives. Second, if a person is not able to deal justly with all four wives, he should not marry more than one. Justice is a value that has to be maintained at all costs and cannot be sacrificed even for such a noble cause. What are the limits of this justice? If this means equality in a person's inner inclination and his outer behavior, then this is not possible for any person. If a person, while being married to a wife he greatly loves, marries a widow for the welfare of the orphans, it is impossible for him to show equal love and behavior for both these wives. Consequently, this very question had arisen in the period of the revelation of the Quran. So in Surah 4 verses 127-130, an answer was given to this question. In these verses, it is first explained that whether marriage has taken place to protect the rights of the orphans, or for some other purpose, payment of dower and discharging of justice are the rights of a woman. and the former must be given with the willingness of the heart, as is also pointed out in Surah 4 verse 3. Women are then counseled that if they fear that husbands may show indifference to them or even think of parting ways with them because of their insistence to be treated equally, it is all right if husband and wife settle for a compromise. The Quran says, "And if any of these women fears cruelty or neglect on her husband's part, there is no blame on the two of them if they arrange an amicable settlement between themselves, and they should consider that such a settlement is best. And, in reality, man is greedy by nature. But if you do good and practice self-restraint, you should rest assured that Allah is well acquainted with all that you do." Surah 4 verse 128. While explaining the above quoted verse, Imam Amin Asan Islahi writes, "This means that a wife may show lenience to her husband in her demand for justice, as well as payment of dower and maintenance to her in order to dispense with the imminent fear of separation." The verse goes on to say that in settlements rest the welfare of all, because it is in the interest of both husband and wife that this relationship once established should continue forever, even if a lot of sacrifice has to be made to keep it intact. Continuing with words of counsel, the verse says that greed is an evil found in human beings that affects mutual relationships. The remedy for this malady is that either both should get ready to make some sacrifice, or if one of them is ill enough by not being willing to do so, the other should take the initiative. So if the wife has to make some sacrifice to keep the family unit intact, it is better that she do so. In the end, the words, "But if you do good and practice self-restraint," of the verse urge the husband to adopt the way of sacrifice and selflessness, and it is only befitting that he show magnanimity and piety in this regard. He should live up to his traditions of grit and character, and instead of being a receiver from the woman, he should let her be the receiver. The Almighty has knowledge of every deed a person does, and He will greatly reward pious deeds. Reference Amin Hasan Islahi Tadabbari Quran, Volume 2, page 399. The subsequent verses delineate the bounds of justice in the following words: "And even if it is your ardent desire, you will never be able to be totally just between women. So it is enough if you do not completely incline yourself to a woman altogether, so as to leave the other side. And if you come to a friendly understanding and fear Allah, Allah is oft forgiving, most merciful. But if they disagree and eventually must part, Allah will provide abundance for each from His bounty. And He is bountiful and wise." Surah 4 verses 129-130. It is evident from the above quoted verses that the requirement of justice between wives does not mean justice between them regarding the husband's inner inclination or external behavior. It is humanly impossible to be just in this matter because one has no power over one's heart in such affairs. Therefore, in this regard, the Quran requires of a husband to not completely lean towards one of the wives and show indifference to the other, as if she had no husband. Consequently, he is asked to show balance in his behavior towards them and in discharging their rights. In case of any fault or blemish in this matter, he should at once try to reform the state of affairs by making amends and should keep fearing the Almighty. If, in spite of the effort, something remains amiss, hopefully the Almighty will have mercy on him. Allah's mercy is all-embracing. The last part of the verse stresses that one should try everything to save the family from dismemberment. This is what Allah wants. However, if owing to compelling circumstances, separation does take place, one should hope for the best from the Almighty. It is He who provides sustenance to His creatures and assists them in hardships. He would fully help both the husband and the wife and fulfill their needs through His grace. Imam Amin Asan Islahi writes, "The implication being that efforts that reflect selflessness and sacrifice are required from both the husband and wife in order to keep this relationship intact. However, this restoration must be done with honor and integrity, just as it is not permissible for either the husband or wife to show vanity in this regard. It is also not permissible to show accommodation beyond a certain point. Although the words used are general, it is evident from the context that the wife is encouraged to adjust and adapt to the situation as much as is possible and also show selflessness to achieve this end. However, she should rest assured that if, in spite of her efforts, the family does not remain intact, the Almighty is the one who provides and sustains all. he will completely fulfill her needs from his treasures. Reference Ibid, Volume 2, page 400. Here, it should be kept in mind that the Prophet ﷺ was exempted from both the above-mentioned restrictions so that he could discharge certain responsibilities that were entrusted to him in his capacity as the final messenger of God. Consequently, in order to raise the status of slaves in the society, the Prophet ﷺ had wedded together his paternal cousin Zainab radiallahu ta'ala anhu and his liberated slave and adopted son Zayd radiallahu ta'ala anhu. However, when this marriage could no longer be pulled along, the Almighty bade the Prophet ﷺ to marry her to comfort and solace her and put an end to the evil social custom according to which a person could not marry the wife of his adopted son. At that time, the Prophet ﷺ already had four wives. The Prophet ﷺ himself thought that perhaps marrying Zainab radiallahu ta'ala anhu was the only way out because of what ensued between her and Zayd radiallahu ta'ala anhu, but he never expressed these thoughts. The Almighty revealed these inner thoughts and told him that the messengers of Allah do not care about the reaction of people while discharging their responsibilities. Consequently, the Prophet's marriage with Zainab radiallahu ta'ala anhu was proclaimed by the Almighty himself in the Quran. And remember, O Prophet, when you were repeatedly saying to one who had received the favor of Allah and your favor, retain your wife in wedlock and fear Allah, and you were hiding in your heart that which Allah was about to make manifest, you were fearing the people, but it is more fitting that you should fear Allah. Then when Zayd broke his relationship with her, we joined her in marriage to you, so that in future there may be no difficulty on the believers in the matter of marriage with the wives of their adopted sons, when the latter have dissolved their relationships of marriage with them. And this command of Allah had to be fulfilled. Surah 33, verse 37. Right after this proclamation, the Almighty revealed detailed directives specifically for the Prophet ﷺ regarding marriage and divorce. In these directives, the above-quoted conditions for polygamy were repealed, but certain other restrictions were imposed on him that were not imposed on other Muslims. O Prophet! We have made lawful to you the wives whom you have paid their dowers, and free women whom God gives in your possession, because of a military campaign, and the daughters of your paternal uncles and aunts, and the daughters of your maternal uncles and aunts, who migrated from Mecca with you, and any believing woman who gifts her soul to the Prophet on the condition that the Prophet wishes to marry her. This directive is specifically for you alone and not for the believers. We very well know what we have imposed on them as obligations regarding their wives and slave girls. A special directive for you so that there be no difficulty for you in discharging your duties, and in case of any blemish, Allah is forgiving and merciful. You have the authority to keep any of them away from you, and keep any of them near you, and it is lawful for you to bring any of them near you whom you have kept away. There is no blame on you in this regard. This explanation is more proper so that they be contented and not be sorrowful, and feel satisfied with whatever you give all of them. And Allah knows what is in your hearts, and Allah is all-knowing and most forbearing. All other women besides these are not lawful for you, nor can you change them for other wives, even though their beauty attracts you. Slave girls, however, are still allowed to you, and in reality Allah does watch over all things. Surah 33, verses 50-52. The statutes on which this group of directives is based are, firstly, after contracting marriage with Zainab radiallahu ta'ala anhu, the Prophet ﷺ could marry further for the following objectives: to honor free women who were caught as captives in some military campaign, to show kind-heartedness to women who wanted to marry him just for the sake of associating themselves to him, and for this they were ready to gift themselves to him, to console and sympathize with his maternal or paternal cousin sisters who had migrated with him from Mecca and left their houses and relatives merely to support and back him. Secondly, since these marriages of the Prophet ﷺ were to be contracted only to fulfill certain religious obligations, he was not required to deal equally between the wives. Thirdly, except for the women specified, he was prohibited to marry any other lady. He could also not divorce any of his wives, nor bring a new one in her place, however much he liked her. Consequently, because of these restrictions, the Prophet ﷺ could not marry Maria radiallahu ta'ala anhu, and she remained in his house as a slave lady. Consequently, the Prophet ﷺ married Juwayriya radiallahu ta'ala anhu and Safiya for the first objective outlined above, Maymuna radiallahu ta'ala anhu for the second, and Habiba radiallahu ta'ala anhu for the third. It also pointed out in these verses that the wives of the Prophet ﷺ are the mothers of the believers. Consequently, marriage is eternally prohibited with them. No Muslim should even think of marrying them after the Prophet's death. The Prophet holds priority for the believers over their own selves, and his wives are their mothers. Surah 33 verse 6. Nor is it right for you that you should marry his widows after him at any time. Truly such a thing is abominable in Allah's sight. Surah 33 verse 53. It is evident from this discussion that these marriage directives were given to Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam as a religious obligation in his capacity as a prophet and a messenger of God. He followed these directives and there was no element of personal desire in these marriages. Consequently, the need arose to make these directives an exception to the general ones given to the Muslims in this regard. Etiquette of sexual intimacy. And they ask you concerning women's courses. Tell them, they are an impurity, so keep away from women in their courses and do not approach them until they have cleansed themselves from blood. But when they have purified themselves after taking a bath, approach them in the manner the Almighty has directed you in your instincts. Indeed, Allah loves those who constantly repent and keep themselves clean. These women of yours are your cultivated land. Go then into your lands in any manner you please, and through this plan for the future, of both this and the next world, and remain fearful to God. And bear in mind that you shall necessarily meet him one day. And O Prophet, give good tidings of success and salvation to the believers on that day. Surah 2 verses 222-223. Sexual relations between a man and a woman stem from their instincts and they do not need any external guidance in this matter. However, can a husband and wife have sexual intercourse when the wife is passing through her menstrual or puerperal cycle? It is evident that the answer to this question should be in the negative, because the very objective of religion is tazkiyah, or purification. Consequently, all divine religions prohibit sexual relations during this period. Under the influence of the religion of Abraham sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the Arabs of pre-Quranic times also considered this relationship to be prohibited. Their poetry mentions this relationship covering a number of aspects. There was no difference of opinion in this matter. However, there were lots of extremes regarding the limits of physical interaction during the time a lady was passing through her menstrual cycle. When people started asking about these limits, the Quran answered the question in the above-quoted verses of Surah Baqarah. While explaining these verses, Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, "The extent to which a husband has been stopped from going near his wife in this period is evident from the Quranic words mentioned subsequently. And do not approach them until they are in a state of purity. Then when they are clean after having bathed, go to them from where God has enjoined you. Only sexual intercourse is prohibited with the wife during this period. It should certainly not be the case that a woman be considered untouchable in this period, as was the case in certain other religions. Some ahadith and the practice of the Prophet ﷺ also elucidate this fact. It is narrated about Aisha radiallahu ta'ala anhu that during her menstrual cycle, she would comb the hair of the Prophet ﷺ when he would be offering itikaf in the mosque. It is further narrated from her that the Prophet ﷺ would read the Quran while placing a pillow in her lap. In another hadith narrated from her, she says that when any of the wives of the Prophet ﷺ would be undergoing her menstrual cycle, and the Prophet ﷺ wanted to be intimate with her, he would direct her to tie a loincloth on the lower part of the body, and he would then approach her. She further narrates that when she would drink water in her menstrual cycle, and then give the same water to the Prophet ﷺ, he would put his lips on the same place on the vessel from which she had drunk. Similarly, when she would chew and suck on a bone and then give it to the Prophet ﷺ, he would place his lips on the same part of the bone where she had placed them. References Al-Bukhari al-Jimi al-Sahi, page 52, number 296 and 297, and page 53, number 302, and Muslim al-Jimi al-Sahi, page 138, number 693.
Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, two words used in this verse, tur and tatahur. The former means the end of the state of impurity and the termination of blood, while the latter means the state of purity a lady enters into after the ceremonial bath. The verse regards tur as a condition for intercourse with the wife, and it also says that once a lady has entered the state of purity, only then should the husband approach her for this purpose. It emanates from this that though the basic reason for this prohibition is blood, and once the blood stops, this prohibition is lifted. However, the desirable way in this regard is to have intercourse after she has bathed. Reference Amin Hassan Islahi Tadabburi Quran, Volume 1, page 1, number 526. It is also explained in the above quoted verses that after the ceremonial bath, sexual intercourse with the wife should be done in the way prescribed by the Almighty. The Quranic words, go to them from where God has enjoined you. This guidance is ingrained in human nature, and from this aspect, it no doubt is a directive of the Almighty. If a person violates this directive, he in fact violates a very obvious directive of the Almighty, and as a result, will have to face punishment from him. The metaphor of cultivated land is employed by the Quran to explain what is stated in the previous verses. Imam Amin Hassan Islahi comments on this in the following words. One very apparent reason for using this metaphor is the fact that just as for a cultivated land, it is essential on the part of the farmer that seeds be sown in the appropriate season at the right time, and no farmer disregards the principle that they be sown within the fields and not scattered outside them. Similarly, it is a norm of human instinct that one should not approach a lady for sexual intercourse during the menstrual cycle or in any unnatural way, because the period of menses is a time during which women are frigid and not inclined, while unnatural intercourse is a painful and wasteful activity. Therefore, people who have not perverted their nature cannot indulge in such an activity. While explaining the expression, go then into your lands in any manner you please, Islahi goes on to write, this alludes simultaneously to two things. On the one hand, it refers to the liberty, freedom, and free manner with which a farmer approaches his land, and on the other hand, refers to the responsibility, caution, and care which he must exercise in approaching his land. It is both this liberty and caution which ascertain the correct behavior of a husband with his wife in this regard. Everyone knows that the real bliss of married life is the freedom a person has in intimate affairs, barring a few broad restrictions. The feeling of this freedom has a great amount of euphoria around it. When a person is with his wife in intimate moments, divine will seems to be that he be overcome with emotions, but at the same time, it is pointed out to him that he has come into a field and an orchard. It is no wasteland or a forest. He may come to it in whatever manner, and in whatever way whenever he pleases. But he must not forget that he has landed in his orchard. The Quran has no objection on the discretion, choice, and majesty with which he approaches his field, if he knows full well where he is going, and in no way is oblivious of this reality. The importance of all these directives is pointed to by the Quran in the words, God indeed loves those who repent and those who adhere to cleanliness. While explaining the importance of these words in the eyes of the Almighty, Islahi writes, if one deliberates on the essence of Tawbah and Tatahur, one comes to the conclusion that while the former means to cleanse one's inner self from sins, the latter means to cleanse one's outer self from filth and dirt. Viewed thus, both are similar in their essence, and the Almighty holds both these traits of a believer in great admiration. On the other hand, people who lack these traits are disliked by the Almighty. It is evident from the context of this verse that those who do not refrain from intercourse with their wives during their periods of impurity and violate the limits ingrained in human nature in satisfying their sexual urge are detestable in the eyes of the Almighty. Reference Ibid, Volume 1, pages 526 and 527. Ila. Those who swear to abstain from their wives must wait 4 months. If they change their mind, Allah is forgiving and ever merciful. But if they decide to divorce them, they should know that He hears all and knows all. Surah 2, verse 226 to 227. The verses of Surah Baqarah mention the directive of Ila. This is a term of the Arab Jahiliyyah society, which means to swear an oath to sever sexual relations with one's wife. Such an oath leaves the wife in an indefinite state, and is as such against justice and fairness, virtue and piety. Consequently, the Almighty has fixed a 4-month period after which a husband must decide to either resume the marital relationship or to divorce her. About the first situation, the Almighty says that He is forgiving and ever merciful. The implied meaning being that although this oath was sworn to usurp rights, and it is not lawful to swear such oaths, but if a person mends his ways, the Almighty shall forgive him. In such a case, the husband would of course have to atone the termination of his oath in the way prescribed by the Sharia. Regarding the second situation, the Almighty says that He hears all and knows all. In other words, what is implied is that if a person decides to divorce his wife, then he must abide by the rules and regulations that the Almighty has prescribed in this regard. Allah hears and knows everything. Excesses committed against someone else will not remain concealed from him. It is evident from this directive that it is not allowed to sever sexual relations from one's wife without a valid reason. So much so, if a person swears such an oath, he must break it. Such relations are the right of a wife, and if a husband does not fulfill them, then he can be regarded a criminal both in the eyes of the law and before the Almighty in the hereafter. In return, the wife also does not have the right to refuse compliance to these relations without a valid reason. The Prophet ﷺ is reported to have said, "When a husband calls his wife to bed for intimacy, and she refuses, and as a result the husband spends the night in anger, then angels curse the wife all night till dawn." Reference Al-Bukhari Al-Jamil Sahih, page 540, number 3237. Zihar. Those among you who commit zihar with their wives, they, these wives, cannot become their mothers. None can be their mothers except those who gave birth to them. And in fact, such people say something very immoral and false. And truly Allah is forgiving and merciful. And in this matter the directive is that those who do zihar with their wives then wish to go back on the words they uttered, then a slave should be liberated before they touch each other. Thus are you admonished to do, and Allah is well acquainted with all that you do. And if a slave is not available to a person, he should fast for 2 months consecutively before they touch each other. And if he is unable to do this even, he should feed 60 indigent ones. This is because you may show your faith in Allah and His Messenger. Those are limits set by Allah. Only the rejectors of Allah and His Messenger cross them. And there is a grievous punishment for such rejectors. Surah 58 verses 2-4. The above quoted verses spell out the directive of zihar. Like ila, this was also a term of the Arab Jahiliyyah society. It meant that a husband had uttered the following words for his wife. "If I touch you, it would as if I touched the back of my own mother." These words in those times would amount to giving such a divorce to the wife after which a wife had to be separated from her husband. The Arabs would say that by saying such words, a husband is not only severing marital ties with his wife, he is also prohibiting her for himself like his own mother. Consequently, though after divorcing a wife, a husband had the right to revoke it, but after doing zihar, there was no chance left for him for any revocation. The Quran here mentions this very directive. The first thing which is stated in the above quoted verses is that if a person is unseemly enough to regard his wife as his mother, or liken some limb of his wife to that of his mother, then such an utterance does not make the wife his mother, and neither is she endowed with the sanctity a mother has. To be a mother is a reality since she has given birth to a person. The sanctity and relationship she is invested with is because of this very fact. This is an eternal and natural sanctity which only a real mother has. No other lady which is called by this name in such a manner can ever possess this sanctity. Consequently, such an utterance neither breaks marital ties, nor does a wife become prohibited for a person like his mother. The Quran, at another place, points to this aspect in the following words, "And Allah has not made your wives whom you divorce by zihar your mothers." Surah 33 verse 4. The second thing which the verses of Surah Mujadala quoted above point out is that if a person utters such a sentence, then he should know that these are very indecent and fallacious words, which no civilized person can ever think of, let alone uttering them. Such a person could have been heavily taken to task by the Almighty, but He is most gracious and most merciful. So if a person overcome by anger says these false and abominable words, and then realizes his mistake, he shall be forgiven by the Almighty. The third thing emphasized in the verses is that a person who utters these words shall not be allowed to go scot-free. Such loose talk gravely affects the social life, and thus it is essential that such a person be punished for this unbecoming behavior so that he is careful in the future and others also learn a lesson from this. Consequently, it is decreed that he must atone his sin before going near his wife in the following manner. A slave woman or a slave man should be set free. If slaves are not available, he should fast consecutively for 2 months. If this is also not possible, he should feed 60 indigent people. The Almighty has said if this directive is followed by the believers in its true spirit, their faith in God and His Prophet will be strengthened. The reason for this is that if a person atones for any of his sins by taking such pains, this not only compensates his sin, but also increases his faith and beliefs. Divorce. O Prophet, when you people divorce your wives, divorce them according to their waiting periods, and count accurately this waiting period, and fear God your Lord. During this waiting period, do not turn them out of their houses, nor should they themselves leave, except in case they are guilty of some open lewdness. These are the bounds set by Allah, and you should know that those who transgress the bounds of Allah, it is they who wrong their own souls. You know not that God might thereafter create new circumstances. Divorce your wives in this very manner. Thus, when they approach the end of their waiting period, either take them back on equitable terms, or part with them on equitable terms. And whether you want to keep them or part with them, in both cases, call to witness 2 honest people from among you. And O witnesses, establish this testimony for God. It is this thing to which those who are exhorted, who believe in God and in the last day. And if those who fear God encounter any difficulty, God will find a way out for them and will provide them from where they cannot even imagine. And those who put their trust in God, for them Allah is enough to help them. God is sure to bring about His designs. God has set a measure for all things. And those of your women who have ceased menstruating, and they also who have not menstruated in spite of reaching its age, if you have any doubts about them, then their waiting period is 3 months. And the waiting period of pregnant women is till they deliver the child. God will ease the hardship of those among you who fear Him. Such is the directive of God He has revealed to you. He who fears God, God shall brush away his sins and shall richly reward him. During the waiting period, lodge these women in your homes according to your means, and do not harass them to make life intolerable for them. And if they are pregnant, spend on them until they deliver the child. And if they suckle your child, give them their remuneration and decide this matter according to the custom after mutual consultation. And if you find yourselves in difficulty, another woman can suckle the child. Let the man of means spend according to his means, and he whose resources are restricted, spend according to what God has given him. God does not burden a person with more than He has given him. Rest assured, after some difficulty, God will soon grant relief. Surah 65 verses 1-7. If it becomes impossible for a husband and wife to get along with one another, there exists in divine religions the option of separation from one another. In religious parlance, this separation is called talaq or divorce. As per the traditions of Abraham's religion, the Arabs were fully aware of it in the Jahiliya period. No doubt certain deviations and innovations had found way in their concept. However, a study of their history reveals that the law of divorce that existed in their society was almost the same as what Islam presented. In the above quoted verses of Surah Talaq, the Almighty has revived with certain additions and amendments that very law. Certain details of this law are also mentioned in Surah Baqarah and Surah Azab, but a little deliberation shows that the basic verses in this regard are those of Surah Talaq stated above. Before divorce. Before circumstances reach an extent that divorce remains the only option, It should be the intense desire of every person to keep intact the marital relationship as far as possible. On these very grounds, in Surah Nisa, the Almighty has permitted the husbands to reprimand his wife if she is guilty of challenging his authority. However, if all efforts of reformation fail, and it becomes evident that this relationship cannot remain intact, the Almighty has asked Muslims to make a last-ditch effort. The relatives of the couple, their clan and tribe, and other well-wishers should come forward and use their influence to set right the situation. The procedure outlined by the Quran in this regard is that one arbitrator should be appointed from the husband's family and another from the wife's family. Both these arbitrators should try to reconcile the two in the hope that what the husband and wife could not accomplish themselves would be accomplished by the elders and well-wishers of the two families. The Quran says, "And if you fear a breach between the two, appoint arbitrators, one from his family and the other from hers. If the husband and wife wish for peace, Allah will create harmony between them, for Allah has full knowledge and is acquainted with all things." Surah 4, verse 35. The last words of the verse subtly urge the couple to benefit from this scheme. If, instead of severing ties, they wish to create harmony among themselves, they should keep in mind that the Almighty is benevolent. He will help them in redeeming the situation. The right to divorce. The surah begins with the words, "When you people divorce your wives." In this verse, in the subsequent ones also, and in other verses of the Quran, where the directive of divorce is mentioned, the husband has been regarded as the initiator of divorce. Moreover, in Surah 2 verse 229, the words used by the Quran for returning the wealth of the husband and thereby seeking divorce from him are, "What the woman gives in ransom." These words bear clear evidence to the fact that the Sharia has granted the husband the right to divorce. The reason for this is quite obvious. A husband has always been charged with the responsibility of protecting his wife and providing for her because God has given him the natural ability to fulfill these responsibilities. On these very grounds, the Quran has regarded him to be the qawam, or head of the family, and explicitly stated, "And the husbands hold a degree of superiority over them." Consequently, both the nature of the responsibility and the respect for his position entail that he be given the right to divorce. I have explained earlier that the institution of family is an essential requirement of a human being. Just as entrusting two parties with different responsibilities, but granting them equal rights to establish an organization or to dismantle it, cannot keep that institution intact, the institution of family also cannot remain intact. Consequently, if a lady, in lieu of her own protection and subsistence and those of her children, has given herself in the custody of a man through a contract, then the right to annul this contract cannot be given to the lady without the permission of the husband. This is in accordance with justice and fairness. If any other option is adopted, then this would be against justice, and would inevitably result in the dismemberment of the institution of family. As a consequence of the above analysis, if a wife wants to separate from her husband, she cannot divorce him. On the contrary, she will demand divorce from him. In general circumstances, it is hoped that every gentleman, seeing that there is no other way out, would accept this demand. However, if this does not happen to be the case, a wife can turn to the court of law. When the state of affairs deteriorates to this extent, then there is a precedent set by the Prophet ﷺ in this regard for the judicial forums. If it becomes certain that a wife has an aversion to her husband and does not want to live with him anymore, then the court should order the husband to divorce her, and if he wants, he can take back all the wealth and property that he gifted to her except the mehr, or dower. Ibn Abbas narrates that the wife of Thabit ibn Qais once came to the Prophet ﷺ and said, "O Messenger of Allah, I do not have any complaint regarding his character and person. However, I fear that I will lose my faith." When the Prophet heard this complaint, he said, "Would you return his orchard?" She showed her consent. At this, the Prophet ﷺ directed Thabit to accept the orchard and separate her by pronouncing one divorce sentence. Reference al-Bukhari al-Jamil Sahih, page 943, numbers 5273 and 5277. Procedure of divorce. whether a husband divorces his wife because of his own decision, or does so at the demand of his wife. In both cases, the procedure of divorce prescribed by the Sharia is as follows. Divorce should be given keeping in consideration the iddat, or waiting period. This means that it is incorrect to divorce a wife in a manner that separates her instantaneously. In all instances, it must be given so that it becomes effective after a specific waiting period. Iddat in religious parlance means the period in which a divorced or widowed lady cannot marry any other person. Since this period has been primarily fixed in order to ascertain whether a lady is pregnant or not, therefore it is necessary that divorce be given after a lady has completed her menstrual cycle, in that period of cleanliness in which the husband did not have any sexual intercourse with his wife. Every Muslim should be fearful of his Lord about emotions of anger, which on such instances do arise against the wife. Consequently, when the Prophet ﷺ was told that Abdullah ibn Umar radiallahu ta'ala anhu had divorced his wife during her menstrual cycle, he was really annoyed and remarked, "Ask him to take her back and keep her in wedlock until she is through with her menstrual cycle, and then once again passes through this cycle and then is through with it. After this, he can either detain her in wedlock or divorce her before having sexual intercourse with her, because it is the beginning of the iddat keeping regard of which the Almighty has directed believers to divorce their wives. The Almighty has directed Muslims to carefully keep count of the period of iddat. Since divorce is a matter of great consequences, and a lot of legal issues arise for the man, the woman, their children, and their whole family, it is essential that the time and date of divorce be properly accounted for. Moreover, it is essential that at the time of divorce, the state of the woman, the date when the iddat commenced, and the date when it will end be kept track of. Whether the whole issue is ultimately settled within the family, or has to be taken to court for settlement, in both cases it is this period of iddat which dictates the time span within which a husband can revoke his decision and take back his wife, or ruju. Similarly, it is the period which will determine the time for which the husband is liable to keep his wife in the house and provide for her. Likewise, the time when the inheritance is to be given to her, and the time when the divorce process is complete and the lady is free to marry again shall be ascertained from the iddat. Until the iddat period expires, the husband has the right to take back his wife. The Quranic words, "Thus when they approach their term appointed, either take them back on equitable terms, or part with them on equitable terms," in Surah 65 verse 2, refer to this fact. The Almighty has further explained in Surah Baqarah that just as the right to give divorce rests with the husband, this right to take back the wife also rests with him, so that the Almighty has granted him one degree of superiority in status in administering the institution of family, which is necessary to maintain order in it. This, of course, does not mean that only husbands have rights and wives have none. People must be aware that just as wives have certain duties regarding their husbands, they also have some rights. Mankind has never been ignorant of these rights. It is well aware of them. Consequently, it is the obligation of the husbands that besides asking their wives to fulfill their obligation towards them, they must also keep in mind their rights. And if their husbands wish to reform affairs, they, the husbands, have greater right to take them back in this waiting period, should they desire reconciliation. And just as according to society's norms, these women have obligations towards their husbands, they also have rights. Although men as husbands have a status above women. This is the directive of Allah, and Allah is mighty and wise. Surah 2 verse 228. Since there is a high probability that in such affairs one is bound to be governed by emotions and extreme reactions, and as a result may commit one blunder after another, these two attributes of God, mighty and wise, mentioned at the end of the verse serve a special purpose. While referring to this purpose, Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, "God is Aziz, or mighty, hence it is only His right to give this directive, and He is also Hakim, or wise. Hence, whatever directive He gives is based on wisdom. Men should always submit to His directives without any hesitation whatsoever. If they oppose His directives, this would amount to challenging His honor, and would only hasten to invite His wrath. Similarly, if they are naive enough to think that they are more wise and sagacious than the Almighty, they will be responsible for ruining the law and system of the society with their own hands. Reference Amina San Islahi Tadaburi Quran, Volume 1, page 533. If the husband does not take back his wife within the iddat period, then once this period expires, the relationship of wedlock will cease to exist. Consequently, the husband is directed to make up his mind once this period is approaching its end. He should decide if he has to revoke his decision and take her back, or is to persist with his decision and sever his relationship with her. In both cases, the Almighty has directed him to follow the maruf, or good conventions, of the society. The Almighty comforts them by saying that those who remain fearful of him should rest assured that they will be worthy of his help if they encounter any difficulty. It is pointed out in Surah Baqarah that if the husband decides to revoke his decision and take back his wife, then this should not be with the intention of hurting or harassing her. The verse of Surah Baqarah quoted above refers to this aspect in the words, "The revocation should not be to satisfy one's desire by tormenting the wife. In fact, the underlying reason for this revocation should be to lead a congenial marital life. Otherwise, this would just be an act of oppression which shall greatly displease the Almighty in the hereafter. And when you have divorced your wives, and they have reached the end of their waiting period, either retain them with kindness or let them go with kindness. But do not retain them with the intention of harm, so that you commit excesses against them. And you should know that whoever does this wrongs his own soul. And do not make a mockery of Allah's commandments. Remember the favors He has bestowed upon you, and the law and the wisdom which He has revealed, of which He instructs you. And keep fearing Allah and know that He has knowledge of all things." Surah 2, verse 231. While explaining this verse, Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, "In the previous verses, the implied meanings were stated positively, but here they are stated negatively in order to caution cruel husbands who could abuse the right of divorce as well as the right to revoke it in the iddat period. Such an attitude, of course, is outright injustice and amounts to playing with the Sharia. Those who are bold enough to do this may think that they are oppressing their wives, however, in fact they wrong their own selves. This is because those who toy with divine directives and exceed the limits set by the Almighty shall have to face a grievous punishment." In the end, a reminder is sounded regarding the blessings of the Almighty. He has made Muslims a chosen ummah and sent a prophet to them from among them to guide them. He has also blessed them with a book to guide them regarding good and evil. It is composed of the precepts of law and wisdom. If they repay this great favor by violating the limits of the Almighty and toying with His Sharia, then they should contemplate the consequences of such a behavior. The verse goes on to warn Muslims to remain fearful of the Almighty and to keep in mind that He has knowledge of all their deeds. In other words, He is granting respite to people in spite of their mischief. However, once He decides to catch them, no one will be able to run away from His grasp. Similarly, if a husband decides to part ways with his wife, he is directed to do so in a befitting manner. The words used in Surah 2 verse 220 in this regard give the following directives. Firstly, whatever amount of wealth, property, clothes, jewelry, and other items that have been gifted to the wife by the husband, they should not be confiscated by him. Here it should be clear that the verse is not referring to the nafqa, or maintenance, and mehr, or dower, which are the absolute rights of a wife, and confiscating them is unthinkable. What is emphasized is that a husband should not take back any gifts he may have given her. There are two exceptions to the above-mentioned directive. First, if it is no longer possible to keep a marriage intact according to the limits set by Allah, and the family elders and the society also support the annulment, but a husband is unwilling to divorce his wife simply because he is concerned about losing wealth, property, or other gifts he has given his wife, then the issue can be resolved in the following manner. The wife can give back part or all of the wealth gifted to her to relieve herself of her marital contract. In such cases, it would be lawful for the husband to accept these returned gifts. Second, if the wife is guilty of open sexual misconduct, since such a behavior destroys the very basis of the marital relationship, it is lawful for the husband to take back any gifts or wealth given to her. The Quran says, "And it is unlawful for you, on this occasion, to take back from them anything you have given them, unless both husband and wife fear that they may not be able to keep within the bounds set by Allah. Then if you also feel that they will not be able to remain within the bounds set by Allah, there shall be no offense for either of them regarding the gifts given by the husband if the wife seeks divorce by returning them to him in ransom. These are the bounds set by Allah, so do not transgress them. And you should know that those who transgress the bounds of Allah are wrongdoers. Surah 2 verse 229. And do not treat them with harshness that you may take away what you have given them, except where they have been guilty of open lewdness, and if you decide to take one wife in place of another. Even if you had given the latter a whole treasure of wealth, take not the least bit of it back. Would you take it by slander and usurping her rights? And how can you take it when you have lain with each other, and at the time of marriage they have taken from you a solemn covenant? Surah 4 verses 19 to 21. For this second situation, a person has been warned not to dare take back by slander any wealth gifted to his wife. Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, "It is absolutely against the decency and integrity of a man to slander and accuse a lady with whom he had pledged to live forever under a firm marriage contract. It was she who had unveiled herself totally to him, and both lived intimately and in great harmony with each other. How unseemly it is on the part of the husband that when relations had to be severed with her, he should try to extract from her what he so willingly spent on her, and should go as far as to malign and accuse her for this base purpose." Reference Ibid, Volume 1, page 271. Secondly, the husband shall not be responsible to give the dower if the wife is divorced, such that the husband has not touched her, or her dower had not been fixed. However, if the dower had been fixed, but a lady was divorced before having sexual relations with her husband, then the husband is liable to pay half the amount of the dower fixed, except if the wife willingly forgoes the total amount, or the husband pays the full amount. The Quran says, "There is no blame on you in the matter of dower if you divorce women before touching them or before fixing their dower. And if you divorce them before touching them, but after fixing of a dower for them, then the half of this fixed dower should be given to them, unless they forego it, or he forgoes it in whose hands is the marriage knot. And if you men forego your right, it is nearer to piety. And do not forget your superiority among yourselves, for Allah sees well all that you do." Surah 2 verses 236 to 237. While commenting on this verse, Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, "Although the fact that the husband has divorced the wife before conjugal contact was made is one motive for the wife to forego her right, the Quran here has urged the husband with regard to his honor and forbearance and his status as a husband to not desire from his wife to forfeit her share. Instead, he should show magnanimity in paying her the full amount. The Quran has appealed to him on three grounds to make this sacrifice. Firstly, the Almighty has given him the right to untie the marital knot, just as he had the right to tie it. Secondly, it is more befitting for the stronger sex to show sacrifice and selflessness, the manifestations of true piety. Thirdly, the one degree of superiority a husband has been blessed with by being made the head of the family unit, since he was naturally suited for this task, requires that he take into account this aspect while dealing with the weaker sex. Its natural requirement is that he should be on the giving end rather than being on the receiving end." Reference Ibid, Volume 1, page 548. Thirdly, a wife at the time of parting should be given some resources of life. The Quran says that this is an obligation of those who fear God and those who are righteous. If a lady is divorced even without going near her, a husband is exhorted to fulfill this obligation. The Quran says, "And divorced women should also be given some resources according to the norms of the society when they are sent off. This is an obligation on those who are fearful of God." Surah 2 verse 241. In Surah Azab, the words, "But give them some resources of life, and part with them in a befitting manner," are used to convey this meaning. In Surah Baqarah, this same directive has been given to husbands for wives whom they divorced, without touching them or without fixing their dower. According to the Quran, The amount of these resources should be ascertained keeping in view the norms of the society and the financial status of the husband, and bestow on them some resources of life while parting from them, the wealthy according to his means, and the poor according to his means. This is an obligation on those who are righteous. Surah 2 verse 236. It is evident from these words that this is an obligation on the husband. If a person does not fulfill it, he might not be liable to any legal action, because this is something which pertains to a person's inner piety and virtue. But he would definitely be held liable in the hereafter before his Lord, and in the hereafter the weight and import of his virtuous deeds would suffer. If a husband revokes his decision within the iddat, the lady will continue to remain his wife. But does this mean that a husband can divorce his wife repeatedly in this fashion whenever he wants and then revoke the decision within the iddat? The Quran has answered this question by saying that a person can only twice exercise this right of divorcing his wife in the iddat and then revoking the decision in his marriage with a lady. The words used are, "This divorce may be pronounced twice, and then a woman must be retained with kindness or allowed to go with kindness." That is, if a person divorces his wife and revokes his decision within the iddat, then he can exercise this right one more time in his life in his marriage. However, once he has used this authority twice, he can no longer use it again the third time. In such a situation, his wife would be permanently separated from him, except if she marries some other person and he then also divorces her. Then, if a husband divorces his wife for the third time, he cannot marry her until she has wedded another man. Then, if this second husband also divorces her, it shall be no offense for either of them to return to each other, if they think that they can now keep within the limits set by Allah. And such are the bounds of Allah. He makes them clear to men who want to gain knowledge. Surah 2 verse 230. In case the same husband and wife want to remarry one another, the above quoted verse of the Quran has imposed three restrictions on them. Firstly, the wife should formalize her nikah, or marriage contract, with someone else. Secondly, the second husband divorces her because for some reason the marriage cannot be pulled along. Thirdly, the two think that after remarriage, the two would be able to remain within the bounds set by the Almighty. In the first and second conditions, the word nikah only implies the legal marital knot, and the word divorce implies the divorce that one gives one's wife when it is no longer possible to keep the marriage intact. Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, "The real thing is that nikah is a known term referring to a marriage contract which takes place between a man and a woman with the intention of living together forever in the bond of matrimony. If this intention does not exist in a nikah, then in reality it is not a nikah. It is more of a plot conspired by a man and a woman. The option of divorce in marriage, upheld by the Sharia, is not part of the original scheme. It is only a last resort to deal with insolvable situations. Consequently, the true nature of a nikah is that it should be solemnized with the intention of living together as husband and wife permanently. If a person honors a nikah only for a certain fixed period, then this is called mutah, and it is totally prohibited in Islam. Similarly, if a person solemnizes a nikah with a lady and then divorces her just to provide her with a legal excuse to marry the first husband, then in religious parlance this is called halala. And, like mutah, it is also totally prohibited in Islam. A person who does such a despicable thing is like a pimp or pander, or as a hadith says, that such a person plays the role of a rented-out bull for breeding. And a person who does this, and he who has it done, are cursed by the Almighty." Reference Ibid, Volume 1, page 537. The third condition has been imposed in order to make divorce a very serious affair, so that people do not carelessly indulge in it. They should only divorce their wives while remaining fearful of the Almighty, and when they think that there is no possibility of keeping the marriage intact. Similarly, when they embark upon marrying someone, they should do so with sincerity of purpose, and with the intention of creating a harmonious relationship. It is not befitting for a believer to adopt an attitude contrary to this. Our jurists add to the above-mentioned three conditions and say that a lady can only be divorced from the second husband once the two have had sexual intercourse. Without this, she is not legally allowed to become the wife of her first husband. They generally present the following three reasons in support of their view. Firstly, the verb, she marries, has been used by the Quran. In this verb, the act of marriage has been attributed to the lady. However, since a lady does not contract marriage, rather a man does, the verb here necessarily implies sexual intercourse. Secondly, the word used for another husband is clearly pointing to the fact that the marriage has already been taken place. Hence, it is imperative that the verb here necessarily imply sexual intercourse. Thirdly, it has been reported that once the Prophet ﷺ stopped a lady from marrying her first husband by saying that she is not legally allowed to marry him until she has had sexual intercourse with the first. The answer to the first and the second of these arguments is clearly given by the Quran. And when you have divorced your wives and they have reached the end of their waiting period, do not prevent them from marrying their future husbands. Surah 2 verse 232. It is evident from this verse that the act of marriage has been attributed to the lady. And from the words used, it is obvious that the words refer to the marital knot and cannot in any way be construed for sexual intercourse. Moreover, it is quite strange to contend that the act of marriage cannot be attributed to the lady. One might dare ask that if this is not possible, then can sexual intercourse be attributed to her? Viewed on similar grounds, it is a man who in fact does it and not a woman. As far as the third argument is concerned, it has arisen because of not understanding a hadith. The way Imam al-Bukhari has narrated it in his Al-Sahih clearly shows that the lady had gotten married only to become legally permissible for the first husband. Consequently, when she lied by saying that her husband was unable to establish marital contact with her, the Prophet ﷺ scolded her and told her that she could now only go back to her first husband after tasting her second husband. This, of course, is not a condition that he imposed. It is the case of stating an impossibility, the implied meaning being that if according to her, her second husband does not have the ability to copulate with her, then she can only be divorced from him after he copulates with her. Which of course he will never, since, according to her, he is not capable of it. Thus, if anything can be adduced from this hadith, it is prohibition of halala. It does not in any way support the view of the jurists. The text of the hadith is as follows. Ikrimah narrates that Rafa'a divorced his wife. Thereafter, she married Abd al-Rahman ibn al-Zubair al-Qurazi. Aisha says that she came to her wearing a green cloak and complained of her husband and showed her her bruises. Women do help one another. So when the Prophet ﷺ came by, Aisha said, I have only seen Muslim women being treated in such a way. Her skin is greener than her cloak. Ikrimah says that when her husband came to know that she had complained to the Prophet ﷺ, he also came over to the Prophet ﷺ, along with his two sons from his other wife. Upon seeing her husband, she got hold of the end of her cloak, letting it hang from her hand, and remarked, My only complaint is that whatever he has is no more than this soft cloth. At this, Abd al-Rahman said, O Prophet ﷺ of Allah, she has told a lie. I am very strong and can satisfy her. The truth of the matter is that she is disobedient and wants to go back to Rafa'a. When the Prophet ﷺ heard this, he said, If this is the case, then you shall not be permissible for Rafa'a unless Abd al-Rahman tastes you. Then, upon seeing the sons of Abd al-Rahman, the Prophet ﷺ remarked, Are these your sons? When he replied in the affirmative, the Prophet said, Do you tell such lies, O Abd al-Rahman's wife? By God! These young boys resemble Abd al-Rahman more than a crow resembles another crow. Reference Al-Bukhari Al-Jami' Al-Sahih, page 1027, number 5825. Whether the husband decides to divorce his wife or to take her back, in both cases the Quran directs him to call in two Muslim witnesses on his decision. The witnesses are directed to remain steadfast on the evidence they give. The reason for this directive is to ensure that either of the parties is not able to refute a decision made and to resolve any other dispute that may arise in this regard. Moreover, this would make the matter very transparent for the people and settle doubts and confusions that may surface. The above paragraphs explain the correct way of divorce. If a person divorces his wife according to this prescribed way, or takes her back during the iddah period, then his decisions shall stand legally implemented. However, if divorce is given in violation of the prescribed way, then this is a legal case that would require a court ruling. Two similar cases of importance which came before the Prophet ﷺ are as follows. The first of these is the case of Abdullah ibn Umar radiallahu ta'ala anhu. When he divorced his wife during her menstrual cycle, Umar radiallahu ta'ala anhu presented his case before the Prophet ﷺ. The Prophet ﷺ expressed great anger when he was informed of these details and said, "Ask him to take her back and retain her in wedlock until she enters her period of purity, and then again passes through her menstrual cycle and is pure again. Then, if he wants, he can permanently retain her or divorce her without having intercourse with her, because this is the beginning of iddat, keeping regard of which the Almighty has directed a husband to divorce his wife." Reference Al-Bukhari Al-Jami' Al-Sahih, page 938, number 5251, and Muslim Al-Jami' Al-Sahih, page 628, number 3657. The second case is that of Rukana ibn Abdi Yazid. By gathering all the narratives of this case, the whole situation that comes to light is that he had divorced his wife three times in one go. He then felt ashamed and presented his case before the Prophet ﷺ. The Prophet ﷺ inquired, "How did you divorce her?" He replied, "I divorced her three times in one go." The Prophet ﷺ again inquired, "What was your intention?" He answered that he wanted to divorce her once only. The Prophet ﷺ told him to reply on oath, which he did, and then said, "If this is the matter, then take her back. Only one divorce has been implemented." Rukana remarked, "O Prophet of Allah, I had divorced her three times." The Prophet said, "I know. Take her back, and this is not the proper way of divorcing a wife. The Almighty has said that if one must divorce his wife, he should do so keeping in consideration the iddat." Reference Abu Dawud, Sunan, Volume 2, page 267 and 270, numbers 2196 and 2206. And Ibn Majah, Sunan, Volume 2, 521, number 2051. Al-Tirmidhi, Al-Jami, Al-Kabir, Volume 2, page 466, number 1177. Ahmad ibn Hanbal, Musnad Volume 1, page 438, number 2383. These narratives have weak chains of narration. However, if they are collected and collated, this weakness is dispelled. The foundations on which the decisions of the Prophet ﷺ are based in both the above quoted cases are: if divorce is not given according to the prescribed procedure, but there is a possibility to make amends for the violation, then the sanctity of the law demands that amends be made. A person has the right to explain his statements. If he says that a particular statement was uttered by him without any intention or with full intention, his explanation can be accepted. If a person says that he has divorced his wife three times, then this can mean that he has in fact divorced her three times, and this can only be a statement that portrays the severity and intensity of his decision. Since both these possibilities exist when these words are said, hence any explanation of the speaker regarding the meaning in which he used them should also be acceptable. However, this does not mean that if there exists evidence contrary to the explanation made, then such an explanation can be accepted. A court has full authority to reject such an explanation if it is not satisfied. Consequently, when Umar radiallahu ta'ala anhu observed that people were no longer careful in uttering the divorce sentence, he declared that he would not even accept a statement of explanation from the husband, and three divorces pronounced would be counted as three. Reference Muslim Al-Jami' Al-Sahih, page 630, number 3673. The directive of iddat. Surah Talaq says that divorce should be given keeping in view the iddat. At another place, the Quran has explained that the period of iddat is three menstrual cycles, and divorced women must keep themselves waiting for three menstrual cycles. Surah 2, verse 228. In this verse, the Arabic word is the plural version. In Arabic, this word means both the menstrual period and the non-menstrual period of purity. While presenting his research on this word, Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, "After much deliberation on the root of the word and its derived forms, I have come to the conclusion that its real meaning is that of menstruation. However, Since every menstrual period is followed by a period of purity, the word is also used in this meaning. This is similar to the usage of the word day for night and vice versa. Every language has such words. Reference Amin Hasan Islahi Tadabburi Quran, Volume 1, page 532. The word used in the opinion of this writer as well means menstruation, because in these verses the real issue is to ascertain whether a lady is pregnant or not. It is the period of menstruation which actually ascertains this, and not the period of purity. Moreover, women are asked to wait in this period, and this waiting period can only be ascertained through the menstrual cycle because its beginning can be known with certainty. In normal circumstances, the iddat is 3 menstrual cycles. However, if a woman does not menstruate because of advancing age or in spite of reaching puberty, then the Quran has specified in Surah Talaq that this period would be 3 months. It has also been stated that the iddat of a pregnant lady extends to childbirth. In Surah Talaq, for women who do not menstruate because of old age, there also exists the condition which can be used if you are doubtful. While explaining this condition, Imam Amin Hasan Islahi writes, "It seems to me that the condition is to differentiate between a lady who does not menstruate because of age but has had sexual intercourse with her husband and a lady in similar state but who did not have sexual intercourse with her husband. For if a lady who does not menstruate because of age has had sexual intercourse with the husband, there might be a chance of pregnancy if her state was temporary for some reason. A similar situation may arise for a lady who has not menstruated in spite of reaching the age, and she has sexual intercourse with her husband. It is possible that the question may arise in the mind of a person that if this was the case, then why did the Quran not explicitly state that the iddat of a lady who does not menstruate because of age and who has had sexual intercourse in 3 months? The answer to this question is that such a statement of the Quran would not have pointed to the underlying reason of iddat, which was essential to be highlighted. This underlying reason is not merely the fact that whether a lady has had sexual intercourse or not, it is the possibility that she may be pregnant." Reference Amin Hasan Islahi Tadabburi Quran, Volume 8, page 442. It also follows from this that since the question of pregnancy does not even arise when a wife has not begun conjugal contact with her husband, hence there should be no iddat for her. In Surah Azab, the Almighty has specifically mentioned this fact. "Believers, when you marry Muslim women and then divorce them before you have touched them, no period of iddat have they for you which you can ask them to complete." Surah 33, verse 49. The directives of iddat which are mentioned in the relevant verses of Surah Talaq are as follows. Firstly, during iddat, neither should a wife leave her house, nor is the husband authorized to turn her out from her house. Living together in this way might hopefully be beneficial for both, and they might reconcile and thus save a family from breaking. The Quranic words, "You know not that God might thereafter create new circumstances," point to this very aspect. Further, a warning is sounded that the directives mentioned are the bounds set by Allah, and anyone who tries to exceed them would not harm Allah in any way. On the contrary, he would only harm his own well-being. It is not that the Almighty has set these bounds for his own benefit. It is for the welfare of his creation that he has set them forth. So anyone who violates them only wrongs his own soul. The only exception to the above directive is that if the basis on which a divorce has been given is open lewdness, which the Quran has termed. In the Arabic language, the term used implies fornication and other lesser forms of sexual contact. Obviously, in such a situation, neither is it proper to demand from the husband to keep the wife in the house, nor can the benefit be attained for which this directive had been given. Secondly, it is stated that a husband should provide residence and maintenance to his divorced wife according to his status. After divorce, a husband can be very stingy in this regard. Consequently, he has been directed not to provide for her in a manner that damages her self-esteem. He should provide according to his resources and the social status he is maintaining. It is further stated that in this period, a husband should in no way try to make life difficult for his wife so that she is soon forced to leave her house herself. It is obvious that after the pronouncement of the third divorce also, a husband shall be responsible to provide residence and maintenance to the divorced wife. The reason is that a lady accepts to remain in iddat only to ascertain whether she is the mother of his child or not. It is to protect his lineage that she undertakes this wait. The words, "Then no period of iddat have they for you which you can ask them to complete," of the above-quoted verse of Surah Azab, clearly point to the fact that if pregnancy is a possibility, then observing the iddat is an obligation imposed on the wife from the husband. Indeed, after the third divorce, a husband does not have any right to revoke his decision and take back his wife. However, as a result of this, the only thing that can be revoked is their living together. In no way can the responsibility to provide her with residence and maintenance be revoked. Consequently, this is absolutely certain that whether iddat is 3 menstrual cycles, 3 months, or extends to the birth of the child, a husband is liable to provide his wife with residence as well as maintenance. Here, some people may object to the above view of this writer by presenting the case of Fatima bint Qais. It is narrated that her husband, Abu Amr, had already divorced her twice. Then, when he was sent to Yemen with Ali radiallahu ta'ala anhu, he sent her the third divorce pronouncement as well. During her iddat, when she demanded residence and maintenance, the relatives of the husband refused this demand. At this, she came to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who decided that she has neither the right to be given residence nor any maintenance. Reference Muslim al-Jami'a al-Sahih, page 639, numbers 3697 and 3698, and Abu Dawud Sunan, volume 2, page 296, number 2290. The above referred to narrative is quoted in some books of hadith, but it is evident from certain other narratives that when her case was presented before the Caliph Umar radiallahu ta'ala anhu, he too refused her demand by saying that he could not accept the verdict of a lady which is against the Book of God and the Sunnah of his Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. When in the time of Marwan ibn Hakam, this case once again came into discussion, Aisha radiallahu ta'ala anhu severely criticized this narrative. Qasim ibn Muhammad inquired from Aisha radiallahu ta'ala anhu, "Are you not aware of the case of Fatima bint Qais?" She replied, "It is better if you do not mention her matter." In another narrative, Aisha's words are, "What has happened to Fatima? Does she not fear God?" A third narrative is from Arwa ibn al-Zubair. He says that Aisha said, "Nothing will benefit Fatima if she narrates this hadith." In still another narrative, Arwa says that Aisha expressed her anger for Fatima and said, "She was in an empty house where none whom she knew lived, and hence the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, for her own protection, had directed her to change her residence." References Muslim al-Jami' al-Sahih, page 642, number 3710, al-Bukhari al-Jami' al-Sahih, page 951, numbers 5321 and 5322, al-Bukhari al-Jami' al-Sahih, page 951, numbers 5323 and 5324, Muslim al-Jami' al-Sahih, page 643, number 3719. Al-Bukhari al-Jami' al-Sahih, page 952, numbers 5325 and 5326. And Ibidh, page 952, numbers 5325 and 5326. This is the real background of the narrative. Hence, no one should consider it worthy of any importance. Besides the above-mentioned directives, the Almighty has given a further directive in Surah Baqarah that no lady should try to conceal her pregnancy during her iddat. It has been indicated a number of times earlier that the very directive to observe the iddat has been given for ascertaining whether a lady is pregnant or not. Consequently, it is an essential outcome of this directive, and the Almighty has forcefully directed us to observe it. And divorced women must keep themselves waiting for 3 menstrual courses. And it is unlawful for them, if they believe in Allah and the Last Day, to hide what He has created in their wombs. Surah 2, verse 228. After divorce. Once a divorce is materialized, one issue that can become a source of dispute is suckling of young children. In the under-discussion verses of Surah Talaq, the Almighty has said that if their mother is willing to suckle them, then the husband shall pay her for this service, and this remuneration shall be ascertained through mutual consultation and in a befitting manner. If such an agreement is not reached between the parents, then according to the Quran, any woman can be asked to suckle the children. It is also told that a rich person should spend according to his means and resources, and a poor one according to his. Neither is it permitted for the rich person to deal with others in a manner that is below his status, nor should a poor person be burdened beyond his means. The Almighty holds a person responsible to obey His directives according to his capacity and status. In Surah Baqarah, this directive has been mentioned in detail. And after divorce also, mothers shall suckle their offspring for 2 whole years for those who desire to complete the term. And the child's father, in such a case, shall have to bear the cost of their food and clothing according to the norms. No one should be burdened beyond his capacity. Neither shall the mother be treated unfairly because of her child, nor the father on account of his child, and his heir shall be accountable in the same way. But if they both decide on weaning by mutual consent and after due consultation, there is no blame on them. And if you decide to engage someone else to suckle your offspring, there is no blame on you, provided you pay the mother in accordance with the norms of the society what you promised. And fear Allah and know that Allah sees well what you do. Surah 2 verse 223. Imam Amin Hassan Islahi, while summarizing the directives of suckling that these verses mention, writes, "It is the responsibility of a divorced lady to suckle her offspring for 2 full years in case the husband wants her to complete the total suckling period. During this period, it is the responsibility of the father to provide his divorced wife with food and clothing, keeping in view the norms of the society. In other words, the status of the husband, the needs of the divorced wife, and her own status shall be kept in consideration while providing her this maintenance. Neither of the parties shall be burdened beyond their capacity. Neither the mother shall be harmed in any way by taking advantage of the fact that she is the mother of the child, nor the father be unduly pressurized in any way on the pretext that he is the father of the child. If the father of the child is dead, his heirs will be responsible for all the above-mentioned rights and obligations. If, through mutual consent and consultation, the estranged husband and wife decide to terminate the suckling period before 2 years, they can do so. If the child's father, or in his absence, the heirs of the child want to suckle the child through some other lady instead of the mother, they are authorized to do so provided what has been agreed with the mother regarding her maintenance is fully honored." Reference Amin Hassan Islahi, Tadabbari Quran, Volume 1, page 545. The second thing which can become a source of dispute is the husband's attitude of hindering further marriage of his former wife. This attitude, whether in the form of open forbiddance on his part, or in the form of covert and stealthy schemes, has been strictly prohibited by the Almighty in Surah Baqarah. He has counseled people that once a lady has been divorced, her former husband has no right to cause hindrance in any decision she makes. She has the liberty to marry whoever and whenever she wants. If her decision to marry is in accordance with the norms of the society, it cannot be objected to in any way. The word the Quran uses implies that though a man and a woman are totally free to take their decision, they must remember not to do anything that is against the norms of decency, and which may damage the honor and repute of the former or future husband, or of the family of the woman herself. The Quran says, "And when you have divorced your wives and they have reached the end of their waiting period, do not prevent them from marrying their future husbands if they have come to an agreement according to the norms of decency. These words of advice are given to every one of you who believes in Allah and the Last Day. This is more decent for you and more chaste. And in reality, Allah knows, but you do not." Surah 2 verse 232. While explaining the last part of the verse, Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, "These sound words of advice are being given to those who believe in Allah and the Last Day. In other words, those who believe in Allah and the Last Day should follow what is being advised, since this is the outcome of true belief. Such an attitude is more pure and seemly. If a lady is impeded in any way to remarry, this may result in great evils in the family and society. It is from here that backdoors to clandestine relations, fornication, hijack, and escaping are opened, eventually bringing great disrepute to those whose false pride induces them to obstruct natural emotions through worthless customs." The words, "and Allah knows, but you do not," at the end implied that man's knowledge and vision is very limited. He cannot fully grasp the ups and downs of life. Therefore, he should follow what the Almighty is directing him to do. Reference Ibid, Volume 1, page 544. Besides the above-mentioned two issues, a third matter that can cause dissension between the divorced couple is the custody of children. The Sharia has not given any directive in this regard, because this matter can only be decided keeping in view the welfare of the children and the circumstances of the parents, which of course vary a lot. However, those in authority can obtain a lot of guidance in this regard from the various cases decided by the Prophet ﷺ, following as an account of some of them. Abdullah ibn Umar radiallahu anhu narrates that a lady came to the Prophet ﷺ and said, "For this son of mine, it is only my belly which was his abode, and my breasts which were his vessel, and my lap which was his dwelling place. Now his father has divorced me, and wants to take him away from me." The Prophet replied, "You are more entitled to keep him until you marry again." Abu Huraira radiallahu ta'ala anhu narrates that in his presence once a lady came to the Prophet. I heard her saying, "My husband wants to take away from me this child, even though he has brought over water for me from the well of Abu Anba, and given me a lot of benefit." The Prophet replied, "Both of you can cast a lot on this." Upon hearing this, the husband said, "Who will quarrel with me regarding this son of mine?" The Prophet asserted, "O son, this is your father and this is your mother. Grasp the hand of the one you want to hold." The child grasped the mother's hand and she took him away. Reference Abu Dawud Sunan, Volume 2, page 292, number 2276 and 2277, and Al-Hakim Al-Mustadrak, Volume 3, page 1069, number 2830. Directives relating to widows. And those of you who die and leave widows behind, they should keep themselves in waiting for 4 months and 10 days. Then when they have fulfilled their term, there is no blame on you about what they do with themselves in accordance with the norms of society. And Allah is well acquainted with what you do. And there is also no blame on you if you tacitly send a marriage proposal to these women or hold it in your hearts. Allah knows that you would soon talk to them. Do so, but do not make a secret promise. Of course, you can say something in accordance with the norms of society. And do not decide to marry till the law reaches its term. And know that Allah has knowledge of what is in your hearts. So be fearful of Him, and know that Allah is most forgiving and most forbearing. Surah 2, pages 234 to 235. The above quoted verses of Surah Baqarah mention the directive of iddat for widows. The first thing mentioned is that the iddat of a widow is 4 months and 10 days. In contrast to the iddat of a divorced lady, the iddat of a widow has been extended by 40 days. The reason is that while a husband has been asked to divorce his wife in the period of purity, in which he has had no sexual intercourse with her, obviously no such requirement can be proposed in the case of a widow. It is to exercise care that 40 days have been added by the Quran to the waiting period of a woman who loses her husband. The second thing stated is that after the waiting period expires, the wife is free to do whatever she deems appropriate for herself. However, she should follow the norms of the society in this matter. In other words, she should not indulge in any activity which damages the repute, honor, and integrity of the family, nor the norms of a society. If all this is kept in consideration, then no blame can be cast on her or her guardians. Writes Imam Amin Hassan Islahi, "What is implied is that one should not blame and censure one another without any reason by equating all un-Islamic customs with Islam. On the one hand, a situation should not develop where the guardians of the widow or the heirs of the deceased husband are censured due to the implication that they got tired of the wife, thus letting her leave much before she could fully mourn the loss of her husband. On the other hand, circumstances should not deteriorate to where the widow herself is censured simply because she became interested in remarrying soon after her husband's death. In all cases, only the bounds of the Almighty should be observed, and one should remember that the Almighty is aware of all the deeds of His creatures." Reference Amin Hassan Islahi, Tadabbari Quran, Volume 1, page 546. The third thing stated is that if a person wants to marry a widow, then it is according to the norms that he takes this decision in his mind during her iddat, or inform her of his intentions in a very tacit manner. However, it is not permitted that he, without considering the sentiments of the affected family, send a marriage proposal to the widow, or make some hidden agreement with her. On such occasions, whatever is said must never exceed the bounds of sympathy and expression of condolences. Consequently, the verses forewarn a person that since it is definite that he would express his intention in such a situation, it should not be in the form of a marriage proposal or some hidden or open agreement. This intention should be expressed in a manner that is befitting to the situation and in accordance with the norms of society. Of course, once the waiting period expires, a person can decide to marry such a lady. At that time, he cannot be blamed in any way. It stems from this directive that the behavior of the widow should also be befitting to the situation she finds herself in. On these very grounds, the Prophet ﷺ directed such women to spend their iddat in the house of their deceased husband in a state of mourning and to refrain from embellishing themselves. He is reported to have said, "A widow should not wear colored clothes, neither golden nor red nor ochre. She should not adorn jewelry nor put on henna or stain her eyes with antimony." Reference Abu Dawud Sunan Volume 2 Page 301 Number 2304. Should such a wife be provided with residence and maintenance during this period? The Quran has answered this question further down in the surah. Husbands should make a will in favor of their wives for the provision of 1 year's residence and maintenance, except if the wives themselves leave the house or take any other similar step. And those of you who die and leave widows should bequeath for their widows a year's provision, and bequeath that in this period they shall not be turned out of their residences. But if they themselves leave the residence, there is no blame on you for what they do with themselves according to the norms of society. And Allah is exalted in power, wise. Surah 2 verse 240. 11. Norms of gender interaction. Believers, enter not the houses other than your own until you have introduced yourselves and wished peace to those in them. That is best for you that you may be heedful. Then if you find no one in the house, enter not until permission is given to you. And if you are asked to go back, for it is purer for you. And Allah has knowledge of all which you do. It is no sin for you to enter non-residential places in which there is benefit for you. And Allah has knowledge of what you reveal and what you conceal. O Prophet, tell believing men to restrain their eyes and guard their private parts if there are women present in these houses. That is pure for them. And indeed Allah is well aware of what they do. And tell the believing women to restrain their eyes and to guard their private parts and to display of their ornaments only those which are normally revealed and to draw their coverings over their bosoms. And they should not reveal their embellishments to anyone save their husbands, or their fathers, or their husbands' fathers, or their sons, or their husbands' sons, or their brothers, or their brothers' sons, or their sisters' sons, or other women of acquaintance, or their slaves, or the subservient male servants who are not attracted to women, or children who have no awareness of the hidden aspects of women. And they should also not stamp their feet in order to draw attention to their hidden ornaments. Believers, turn to Allah in repentance that you may prosper. Surah 24 verses 27-31. In order to protect the society from moral misconduct and to safeguard the sanctity of personal relationships, the above quoted verses outline the norms and etiquette of gender interaction. They are stated in Surah Nur, with the warning that these norms of social interaction and communal contact must be adhered to in order to maintain the purity of heart and are the most appropriate set of principles in this matter. If people follow these norms, they will obtain the great blessings and favors they entail. However, to obtain these, it is essential that they follow these norms while regarding the Almighty to be all-embracing in knowledge and always remain aware of the fact that the Almighty is not only aware of their deeds, but also the intentions and motives behind them. These norms are, if friends, relatives, or acquaintances visit one another, they should follow a certain decorum. Suddenly barging into a house without introducing oneself is improper. On such occasions, the visitor should first of all properly introduce himself by paying salutations to the residents of the house. This will make the residents aware of the visitor, provide them with the opportunity to determine the purpose of his visit and whether it is appropriate for them to let him in. If the visitor hears a reply to his salutations and is given permission, only then should he enter. If there is no one present in the house to give him permission, or if someone is present and the visitor is told on his behalf that meeting him is not possible, he should retreat without any feelings of ill will. In this regard, while explaining this directive, the Prophet ﷺ has directed the visitor to seek permission 3 times, and if he hears no reply, even after his 3rd call, he should turn back. Reference Al-Bukhari Al-Jami'il Sahih, page 1087, number 6245. Muslim Al-Jami'il Sahih, page 959-960, number 5633. Similarly, the Prophet ﷺ is reported to have said that the permission to enter must not be sought by standing right at the front door of the house and while peeping in, because the very reason for seeking permission is that the visitor should not catch a glimpse of the residence. In case the visited place is non-residential, no formal permission is required. The Quran uses specific words for such places. They include hotels, rest houses, guest houses, shops, offices, and meeting places. A person can enter such places because of some need without seeking permission as per the dictates of this verse. In both types of visited places, if women are present, then the divine directive is that both the men and women present should restrain their gazes. If there is modesty in the gazes, and men and women refrain from feasting their eyes on the physical attributes of one another and ogling each other, then no doubt the purport of the directive stands fulfilled. The expression used does not mean that men and women should not look at each other, or have to constantly stare at the floor while interacting with one another. It means to guard one's gaze from taking undue liberty, and to refrain from staring at one another. If this vigil on the eyes is not kept, then in the eyes of the Prophet ﷺ, this would be tantamount to adultery of the eyes. Once a person indulges in it, his sexual organ either fulfills the ultimate objective of what his eyes initiated, or is unable to do so. It is regarding this first accidental gaze about which the Prophet ﷺ has directed the believers to turn it away. Jarir ibn Abdullah reports that he asked from the Prophet ﷺ, "What if such a glance takes place suddenly?" The Prophet ﷺ replied, "Immediately turn it away or lower it." Once during the Prophet's farewell pilgrimage, when a lady from the Khatam tribe stopped the Prophet ﷺ on his way, Fadl ibn Abbas started to stare at her. When the Prophet ﷺ saw him, he caught hold of his face and turned it to the other side. One must properly guard one's sexual organs on such occasions of interaction. The implication is that they should have neither any inclination for others, nor should they be revealed to others. In fact, on occasions of gender intermingling, body parts which need to be covered must be covered even more carefully. The primary way to achieve this end is to wear decent clothes. Men and women should wear such clothes which not only hide their embellishments, but also the sexual organs. Moreover, on such occasions, care should be taken that a person does not expose his sexual organs. This is the very objective of guarding the sexual organs. The Quran wants that believing men and women, besides restraining their eyes, also observe this norm of modesty. It is necessary for women in particular not to display any of their embellishments except before their close relatives, attendants, and people of acquaintance. However, exempted from this are embellishments adorned on limbs which are generally never covered. For example, the jewelry and makeup worn on the hand, the face, and the feet. In the opinion of this writer, the correct meaning of the Quranic words is pointed out by Al-Zamakhshari in the words, "Except limbs which a person does not cover generally and instinctively, and they are always left bare. Therefore, barring the embellishments worn on these places, women must hide the ones worn in all other places. So much so, in the presence of men, they should not walk by striking their feet in a manner which draws attention to any hidden embellishments they may be wearing." On these very grounds, the Prophet ﷺ bade women not to use strong perfumes when they go out. Relatives and people of acquaintance before which the above-mentioned display of ornaments is not forbidden are husband, father, father-in-law, For the latter two relations, the word used by the Quran is Abba. This word not only implies the father, but also the paternal and maternal uncles and grandfathers. Therefore, a lady can display her embellishments before adults of both her maternal and paternal family and those of her husbands, just as she can before her father and father-in-law, sons, sons of the husband, brothers, brothers' sons, sisters' sons. The word son implies the grand and great-grandsons, both maternal and paternal ones, without any discrimination of real or step relations. The same implies for the sons of brothers and sisters. In these relations also, the sons of real, step, and foster brothers and sisters are understood to be included. Women of acquaintance and maids. It is evident from these words that unknown women should be treated the same way as men, and a Muslim lady should be very careful in displaying her concealed embellishments before them. The reason is that at times a woman can have sexual leanings towards her own gender. Similarly, at times, being influenced by the physical features and attributes of other women, they become a means of inclining men towards these women and vice versa too. Slaves. The institution of slavery existed in Arabia in the times of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The words used in the above quoted verses while referring to this institution have resulted in some jurists having understood this expression to only mean slave women. However, there is no reason for this exception. Writes Imam Amin Hassan Islahi, had only slave women been implied by this expression, then the chosen words would have been different. A common expression that connotes both slave men and slave women would never have been used. Moreover, the verses already mention the category which, as has been explained, includes both women with whom one is generally acquainted, as well as slave women and maidservants. After a mention of this category, an independent mention of slave women is needless. People who live in a house as dependents and because of their subservience or owing to any other reason are incapable of feeling any attraction towards women. Children who are as yet unaware of sexual matters. Since the chest of women is a means of sexual attraction, and also there may be jewelry worn around the neck, they are further directed to cover their chests with a cloak on such occasions. In this way, the neckline shall also be covered as much as possible. If by some other means than the cloak this purpose is achieved, then this cannot be objected to either. The real objective is that women must not reveal their chest and neckline before men. On the contrary, these should be concealed in a manner that neither do they nor any embellishments worn on them become prominent in any way. The surah also mentions certain other clarifications regarding these norms. Firstly, slave men and women and sexually immature children who generally frequent a house are not required to take permission every time they enter private rooms. They are just required to seek permission in three specific times of the day: before the Fajr prayer when the residents are generally in bed, during the nap in the afternoon when they may not be wearing proper clothes, and after the Isha prayer when they go off to bed for sleep. These three periods of time require privacy. If someone suddenly enters a private room in these times, he may see the residents in an inappropriate state. Barring these three times of the day, sexually immature children and slave men and women can enter the private rooms and other areas of the house without taking any permission. This, then, cannot be objected to. However, in the above-mentioned three times, they must seek permission when they want to enter a private room. Also, children, once they reach sexual maturity, must seek permission at all times. The fact that they have been frequenting the house ever since their childhood is not reason enough for them to continue with the exception granted to them. Consequently, once they reach this age, they must follow the regulations that pertain to all. Believers, let your slave men and women and those who are under age ask your permission on three occasions when they come in to see you: before the Fajr prayer, when you have put off your garments in the heat of noon, and after the Isha prayer. These three occasions are times of your privacy. At other times, it shall be no offense for you or them, because you go around visiting one another. Thus God explains to you His verses, and God is all-knowing and wise. And when your children reach the age of mental maturity, let them still ask your permission as their elders do. Thus God explains to you His verses, and God is all-knowing and wise. Surah 24, verses 58 to 59. Secondly, the directive of covering the chest and the neckline does not pertain to old women, who are no longer of marriageable age, on the condition that their intention is not to display their ornaments. It is not necessary for a woman to cover her chest and neckline in the age in which she generally loses her sexual urge and in which a man feels no attraction for her. So, in the presence of men, old women can dispense with a cloth that covers the stipulated area. However, what is more pleasing in the sight of Allah is that even in this age, they be careful and not dispense with this garment. And it shall be no sin for aged women who have no hope of marriage to discard their cloaks on the condition that they do not display their embellishments. And if they exercise caution, it is better for them. And God hears all and knows all. Surah 24, verse 60. Thirdly, it is explained in these verses that there is absolutely no harm if people and their relatives, who are disabled or impaired in any manner, come and visit one another, and whether men and women among them, eat together or separately in their own houses, of their fathers or grandfathers, mothers, brothers, and sisters, of their paternal uncles and aunts, maternal uncles and aunts, of people who are financially dependent on them, and of their friends' houses. Indeed, when they enter such houses, they must greet the residents in the prescribed way. The Muslim religious greeting, Assalamu alaikum, is in fact a beautiful invocation to the Almighty to strengthen personal relationships. The norms of social interaction that are outlined in these verses are not meant to deprive people of mutual support or to curtail their social freedom. If people show prudence, they can maintain all these relationships even after following these norms. They must not think that these directives are meant to put them through difficulties. The Almighty does not intend to prohibit social interaction in any way. There is no harm if the blind, the lame, and the sick eat at your table, nor if you eat in your own houses, your fathers or grandfathers, your mothers, your brothers and your sisters, your paternal uncles, your paternal aunts, your maternal uncles, your maternal aunts, or of those who are financially dependent on you or your friends. There is no harm if men and women eat together or apart. However, this much you should do, that when you enter a house, say, "Peace to you," a blessed and noble invocation fixed by God. Thus God explains to you His revelations, so that you may grow in wisdom. Surah 24, verse 61. These are the norms of social interaction in general circumstances. However, in the age of the Prophet ﷺ in Medina, when some miscreants started teasing and besmearing the characters of Muslim women, the Almighty in Surah Azab bade the wives of the Prophet ﷺ, his daughters, and other Muslim women to draw over them any of the shawls they have when they go out to places which were insecure. Such dressing up would distinguish them from women of lewd character, and they would not be teased on the pretext of being outwardly similar to such women. It is reported in various narratives that when Muslim women in the dark of the night or in the dim light of dawn would go out to relieve themselves, these miscreants would get after them, and when they would be called to account, they would say that they actually wanted to talk to such and such a woman, thinking that she was a slave woman. The Quran says, "And those who harass believing men and believing women for what they never did should know that they shall bear the guilt of slander and a grievous sin. O Prophet, in this situation enjoin your wives, your daughters, and the wives of true believers to draw over them a shawl when they go out. It will become possible from this that they be distinguished from other women and not be harassed. God is ever forgiving and merciful. If, after these measures also, these hypocrites and those who have the ailment of jealousy in their hearts, and the scandal-mongers of Medina do not desist, we will rouse you against them, and their days in that city will be numbered. Cursed be they, wherever found, they would be seized and put to exemplary death." Surah 33, verses 58 to 61. It is evident from the words and their context that they do not contain any directive related to hijab. It was a temporary measure adopted to distinguish the identity of Muslim women in order to protect them from the evil of lecherous people and from those who indulge in unfounded slander. Owing to similar reasons, the Prophet ﷺ also forbade Muslim women from traveling alone on long journeys and from walking on pathways within a crowd of men. Consequently, if today Muslim women are faced with similar circumstances, they should adopt a similar measure to make themselves distinct from other women and to protect themselves. The surah also mentions certain directives that are specific to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in his capacity of a messenger of God. They bear no relation to other people. However, since certain scholars have extended their sphere of application to all Muslims, their explanation seems appropriate here. A deliberation on the contents of the surah reveals the fact that when the hypocrites and miscreants mentioned above embarked upon a campaign to scandalize the private lives of the wives of the Prophet ﷺ, to make the common man averse to them, and to damage the moral repute of both Islam and the Muslims, the Almighty took certain measures to curb this evil. First, He gave the noble wives the choice to leave the Prophet ﷺ and live the life of common Muslim women, enjoying its luxuries and comforts, or to once again decide with full awareness to live forever as the wives of the Prophet ﷺ, in order to obtain the comforts and luxuries of the hereafter. They were then informed that if they decided to stay with the Prophet ﷺ, then they must realize that their status as his wives entails great responsibility. They are not like common women. They are like the mothers of the believers. Therefore, if they remain faithful to Allah and His Prophet ﷺ and do righteous deeds with full sincerity, they will earn a twofold reward. Likewise, they will be worthy of a twofold punishment in relation to other women if they commit a sin. Their inner purification is beyond doubt. However, the Almighty also wants to morally cleanse them in the eyes of the people, so that no one is given a chance to even cast slight aspersions on their characters. This is a requisite of their status, and they must adopt certain things in their daily lives to achieve this purity. Firstly, if they are fearful of the Almighty, they should not be kind and affectionate in speech to every person who enters their house. Though in normal circumstances, one must be gentle and kind when he speaks to others, but in the circumstances they are facing, such an attitude would only embolden the miscreants and the hypocrites around them to take undue advantage of them. Such an attitude of kindness would create in them the expectation of success in their mission, the mission of whispering evil in people's hearts. So if ever they have to talk to such people, they must speak in clear and simple tones, so that those among their addressees who intend evil realize that they cannot achieve their objective. The Quran says, "Wives of the Prophet, you are not like other women. So, if you fear God, do not be too complacent in your speech, lest the lecherous-hearted should lust after you. Talk with such people in plain and simple words." Surah 33, verse 32. Second, they should remain in their homes in order to protect their rank and status. All their attitudes and mannerisms should be in accordance with the status that the Almighty has conferred upon them. So if they have to go out to meet some compelling need, they must not go out displaying their ornaments and finery, something which was the way of women of the age of ignorance. Both their status and responsibility entail that they remain in their houses and diligently pray and pay zakah as much as they can, and with full sincerity spend their time in obedience to the Almighty and His Prophet ﷺ. However, if due to some unavoidable reason they must leave their place, then they should do so in the most befitting of manners, exemplifying the culture and tradition of the Muslims, and not let any hypocrite raise any objection against them. And abide still in your homes and do not display your finery as women used to do in the days of ignorance. Attend to your prayers, pay zakah, and obey God and His Messenger. Women of this house, the Almighty wants to cleanse you from the filth these hypocrites want to besmear you with, and to fully purify you. Surah 33, verse 33. Thirdly, they should try to communicate the verses of the Quran as well as the beliefs and moral teachings of Islam to people who come and visit them, and refrain from other general gossip. It is for this very objective that the Almighty has chosen them. Their purpose of life now is the dissemination of the message of Islam and not indulgence in the luxuries of life. And communicate to your visitors what is taught to you of the verses of God and the wisdom revealed by Him. The Almighty is very discerning and all-knowing. Surah 33, verse 34. It seems that even after all these measures, the miscreants did not mend their ways. Consequently, the Almighty gave some more directives to Muslims which were to be strictly followed. Muslims were told that no one should enter the house of the Prophet ﷺ unless he was called. If people are invited to have food at the house of the Prophet ﷺ, they shall come right at the time of food. They shall then disperse immediately afterwards and not keep talking to one another. The wives of the Prophet ﷺ shall be secluded from the Muslims, and except for near relatives and women of their acquaintance, no one shall come in front of them. Any who wants something from their private places must ask for it from behind a veil. The wives of the Prophet ﷺ shall be the mothers of the believers. Those hypocrites who have the desire to marry them should know that even after the death of the Prophet ﷺ, they cannot marry them. They are eternally prohibited for marriage after him. Consequently, every believer should honor and respect them the way he honors and respects his own mother. The Prophet ﷺ is greatly distressed by the wrong attitudes of these miscreants. They must now be aware that bothering the Prophet ﷺ is not something trivial. A person may fashion out an excuse for his misdemeanor in this world, but he would not be successful in justifying it before the Lord of the worlds, who is aware of what is in their hearts. Believers, do not enter the houses of the Prophet except if you are permitted some time to enter for a meal. In this case also, do not sit to waiting for the food to be cooked. But if you are invited, enter, and when you have eaten, disperse. Do not engage in familiar talk, for this would distress the Prophet, and he would feel shy to bid you go. But of the truth God does not feel shy. And if you ask his wives for anything, speak to them from behind a curtain. This is more pure for your hearts and their hearts. And you must not harass God's messenger, nor shall you ever wed his wives after him. This would be a grave offense in the sight of God. Whether you reveal or conceal them, God has knowledge of all things. It shall be no offense for these women, the Prophet's wives, to come before their fathers, their sons, their brothers' sons, their sisters' sons, their women of acquaintance, or their slaves. O women of the household of the Prophet, have fear of God. Surely God observes all things. Surah 33, verse 53-55. Directives relating to parents. And we enjoined man to show kindness to his parents. With much pain his mother bears him, and he is not weaned before he is 2 years of age. We said, be grateful to me and to your parents. To me shall all things return. But if they press you to serve besides me that of which you have no knowledge, do not obey them. Remain kind to them in this world, and turn to me with all devotion. To me you shall all return, and I will declare to you everything you have done. Surah 31, verses 14-15. All divine scriptures instruct man to show kindness to the parents. Various verses of the Quran also direct the believers to be well behaved to the parents. For example, Surah 17, 23-24, Surah 29, verse 8, and Surah 46, verse 15. The above quoted verses, however, specifically determine the limits of good behavior with the parents. The details of this directive, as stated in these verses, are: it is the parents who bring into existence a new life and become the means to nourish it. No doubt, the care and affection of the father is quite a lot. However, the hardships a mother encounters in bringing up the child, starting from her pregnancy to childbirth and then breastfeeding the child, are unmatched, and no child can repay her for this great service. On these very grounds, the Prophet ﷺ has regarded the right of the mother as three times that of the father. Reference Al-Bukhari Al-Jami' Al-Sahih, page 1045, number 5971. In Muslim al-Jami' al-Sahih, page 1117, number 6500. Consequently, the Almighty exhorts man to be the most grateful to his parents after his Lord. This gratitude must not be expressed merely by the tongue. Its essential corollary is that it should manifest in good behavior towards them. He should respect them and never become fed up of them. He must not utter a single word of disrespect to them. Instead, he should be soft, sympathetic, loving, and obedient to them. He should listen to them and be caring and affectionate to them in the tenderness of old age. The Quran says, and your Lord has enjoined you to worship none but him, and to show great kindness to your parents. If either or both of them attain old age in your presence, show them no sign of impatience, nor rebuke them, but speak to them kind words. Treat them with humility and tenderness, and say, Lord, be merciful to them the way they nursed me when I was an infant. Your Lord best knows what is in your hearts. If you remain obedient, He will forgive those who turn to Him. Surah 17, verses 23-25. In spite of the status that Islam confers upon parents, they do not have the right to force their children to baselessly associate someone with the Almighty. The Prophet ﷺ has said that showing disobedience to parents is the greatest sin after polytheism. However, the above quoted verses of Surah Luqman say that the children should openly disobey their parents with regard to polytheism and should follow the way of those who follow God. Any calls to evade the Almighty must not receive any positive response, even if it is the parents who are giving the call. On these very grounds, the Prophet ﷺ is reported to have said, No one can be obeyed if he calls to disobey the Almighty. One can only obey what is virtuous. Reference Al-Bukhari Al-Jami Al-Sahih, page 1046, number 5976, and Muslim Al-Jami Al-Sahih, page 53, number 259. Consequently, all other directives of the Almighty shall also be considered subservient to this directive, and one cannot disobey these directives if the parents ask them to do so. Even if the parents force their children to commit a sin as heinous as polytheism, they must always be treated in a befitting manner. Their needs should be met as far as possible, and a prayer of guidance be continued to be made for them. This is what the words, "Remain kind to them in this world," of the verse mentioned before entail. The children may have a right to disobey their parents if they insist upon disobedience to the directives of religion, but they must still not be slack or indifferent in any way to their duty towards their parents. The last part of the verses caution a person that one day he has to return to the Almighty to give an account of his deeds. While commenting upon this part of the verse, Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, This part of the verse addresses both the parents and the children and carries both a warning and an assurance. One day, each person will have to return to the Almighty. Whatever he would have done would be brought before him. If some parents had violated the rights given to them regarding their children by making them deviate from the path of the Almighty, they will have to face punishment for this attitude, and if children duly recognize the rights of the Almighty together with those of their parents, as well as remaining steadfast in following the obligations these rights entail, they will be rewarded for their perseverance. Reference Amin Hassan Islahi, Tadabbari Quran, Volume 6, page 130. Directives relating to orphans. And give the orphans the wealth which belongs to them. Neither exchange their valuables for your worthless ones, nor devour their wealth by mixing it with yours. Indeed, this is a great sin. And if you fear that you cannot treat orphans equitably, then you may marry their mothers, who are lawful to you. 2-2, 3-3, or 4-4 of them. But if you fear that you cannot maintain equality among them, marry one only or any slave girls you may own. This will make it easier for you to avoid injustice. And give these women also their dower the way it is given. But if they choose to give to you a part of it, you may consume it willingly. And if the orphan is naive and mentally immature as yet, do not give to these immature the wealth with which Allah has entrusted you for their sustenance and support, but feed and clothe them with its proceeds, and say words of kindness to them. And keep judging these orphans until they reach a marriageable age. Then if you find them capable of sound judgment, hand over their wealth to them, and do not devour it by squandering it, and consuming it hastily, fearing that they would soon come of age. And let the guardian of the orphan who is rich abstain from his wealth, and the guardian who is poor eat from it, in lieu of his service according to the norms of society. Then when you hand over their wealth to them, call in some witnesses, and Allah alone suffices to take account of all your actions. Men shall have a share in what their parents and kinsmen leave, and women shall have a share in what their parents and kinsmen leave, whether this legacy be little or much, as an ascertained amount. However, if relatives, orphans, or the needy who happen to come by at the division of an inheritance, give them too a share of it, and speak to them kind words. And those people should fear that if they themselves would have left their young children after their own death, they would have been very anxious. For this reason, fear Allah and speak for justice in every matter. Undoubtedly, those who unjustly devour the wealth of orphans swallow fire into their bellies, and soon they shall burn in the flames of hell. Surah 4, verses 2-10. The Quran has referred to the welfare of the orphans and to the attitude of kindness and affection that should be adopted towards them at various places. In the quoted verses of Surah Nisa, certain specific directives are given about them. They can be summarized as follows. Guardians of the orphans should return their wealth to them and should not think of devouring it themselves. They should know that unjustly consuming the wealth of orphans is like filling one's belly with fire. Furthermore, this will lead them to the fire of hell in the hereafter. So no one should try to swap his poor merchandise and assets for their good ones. Neither should a person try to benefit from their wealth while mixing it with his own, feigning administrative ease. If such intermingling needs to be done, then it should only be for the orphan's welfare and well-being and not to usurp their wealth. Protecting the orphan's wealth and safeguarding their rights are significant responsibilities. If it becomes difficult to fulfill these responsibilities alone, and people think that ease and facility can be created by involving the mothers of the orphans, then they can marry the lawful among them. Their number should not exceed 4. However, such multiple marriages should only be resorted to if a person is able to deal justly with the wives. If they think that they would not be able to do so, then even for an objective as noble as welfare of the orphans, they should not marry more than one. Justice should always reign supreme. Moreover, while entering into marriage, the mothers of the orphans should also be given mehr, or dower, just as other women are given. The pretext that marriage has been contracted with them for the welfare of their own children is not acceptable in this regard. However, if such a mother gladly forgoes a portion or the total mehr amount, then of course this generosity can be benefited from. Wealth is a means of sustenance and subsistence for people. It should not be wasted. Consequently, the directive of returning to orphans their money should be carried out when they reach maturity and are able to properly manage their wealth. Prior to this, it should remain in the protection of their guardians, who should continue to judge the orphans regarding their ability to manage and handle daily affairs. In this interim period, however, the orphans' needs should be provided for. The guardians should not hastily consume the wealth of the orphans, fearing that they will lose access to this wealth because the orphans will soon reach maturity. In addition, the guardians must take note to speak very affectionately to the orphans. If a guardian is well off, he should not take anything from the orphans in return for his service, and if he is poor, he can take his due according to the norms of the society. Imam Amin Hassan Islahi writes, "Norms means to benefit in a sensible manner from the wealth of the orphans in a way that is congruous with the nature of obligations, status of the property, general circumstances, and the standard of living of the guardian. It should not be the case that a sane person should start speedily devouring and consuming the wealth of an orphan, thinking that he would soon reach the age of maturity." Reference Amin Hassan Islahi, Tadabburi Quran, Volume 2, page 255. When the time comes to hand over an orphan his wealth, some trustworthy and reliable people should be made witnesses in order to avoid any misconceived notions and dissensions. One should also remember that one day this account shall be presented before the Almighty. He sees and knows all things, and nothing can be hidden from him. Although the shares of the heirs to a deceased are fixed, yet if at the time of distribution of inheritance some close relatives, orphans, or poor people happen to come by, then even though they may not have any legal right in the inheritance, they should be given something and be spoken to in a befitting manner at their departure. On such occasions, a person should always keep in mind that his own children can become orphans, and he may one day have to similarly leave them at the mercy of others. Slavery. And if any of your slaves ask for mukatabat, give it to them if you know any good in them, and for this give them out of the wealth which Allah has given to you. Surah 24, verse 33. This quoted verse of Surah Nur mentions the directive of mukatabat. At the time of the revelation of the Quran, the institution of slavery was as essential to the economic and social needs of the society as the institution of interest is considered in present-day societies. In markets, slave men and slave women were bought and sold, and affluent houses had slave men and slave women of all ages. In such circumstances, a sudden directive for their emancipation would have resulted in many evils. For livelihood, men would have been forced to resort to beggary and women to prostitution. For this very reason, the Quran adopted a gradual way to eradicate this evil from the society, and after many gradual measures of eradication, the above quoted verses revealed a directive for their liberation. The word muqatabat, used in it as a term which means that a slave make a contract with his master, according to which he would be required to pay a certain sum of money in a specific time period, or would carry out a specific service for his master, once he successfully fulfills either of these two options, he would stand liberated. In the above quoted verse, the Almighty has directed the Muslims to necessarily accept this contract made by a slave, if he wants to make it and has the required ability to become financially independent. It is further stated that a Muslim government should spend money from the public treasury, which here is called the treasury of God, in helping such slaves. It is evident from the words of the verse that just as this right of muqatabat was granted to slave men, it was also granted to slave women. This, in other words, was in fact a declaration that slaves could now be masters of their destiny and could obtain liberation whenever they wanted. The above stated verse is the last directive regarding slavery. Prior to this, various other directives were given at various stages, because of which it gradually became possible for this evil to be eradicated from the society. These are summarized as follows. In the very beginning of its revelation, the Quran regarded emancipation of slaves as a great virtue, and urged people in a very effective way to do so. The tremendous appeal found in the words it adopted, "release the necks," can be well imagined by a person who has flair for the language. It is evident from the context of such expressions, wherever they are found in the Quran, that it has regarded this virtue to be the first as well as the greatest step in pleasing God. Reference Surah 90, verse 13. In a similar manner, the Prophet also urged Muslims to liberate humanity from the yoke of slavery in the following words. Whoever liberated a Muslim slave, the Almighty in return for every limb of that slave would shield every limb of that person from hell. Reference Al-Bukhari Al-Jami' Al-Sahih, page 407, number 2517, and Muslim Al-Jami' Al-Sahih, page 657, number 3795. People were urged that until they free their slaves, they should treat them with kindness. The way their masters had total and unchecked control on them in the age of ignorance was put an end to. They were told that slaves are human beings too, and no one should in any way violate the rights they possess as human beings. Abu Huraira radiallahu ta'ala anhu narrated from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, "A slave has a right to food and clothing, and he shall not be asked to carry out an errand that is beyond him." Reference Muslim al-Jami' al-Sahih, page 732, number 4316. Abu Dhar al-Ghifari radiallahu ta'ala anhu narrates from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, "They are your brothers. The Almighty has made them subservient to you. So whatever you eat, feed them with it. Whatever you wear, clothe them with it, and never ask them to do something which is beyond them, and if there is such a task, then help them out with it." Reference al-Bukhari al-Jami' al-Sahih, page 1056, number 6050, and Muslim al-Jami' al-Sahih, page 732, number 4313 and 4315. Ibn Umar radiallahu ta'ala anhu narrates from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam that he heard him say, "Whoever slapped a slave or beat him up should atone this sin by liberating him." Reference Muslim al-Jami' al-Sahih, page 729, number 4298. Abu Masud al-Ansari radiallahu ta'ala anhu says, "Once when I was beating my slave, I heard a voice from behind me, 'O Abu Masud, you should know that the Almighty has more power over you.' When I turned my back, I found that it was the Prophet. I immediately remarked, 'O Messenger of God, I release him for the sake of God.' The Prophet said, 'Had you not done this, you would have been given the punishment of the fire.'" Reference Abid, page 731, number 4308. Ibn Umar radiallahu ta'ala anhu narrates that once a person came to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and asked, "How many times should we forgive our servant?" At this, the Prophet kept quiet. He asked again, and the Prophet again kept silent. Upon being asked the third time, he answered, 70 times in a day. Reference Abu Dawud Sunan, Volume 4, page 343, number 5164. And Al-Tirmidhi Al-Jami Al-Kabir, Volume 3, page 500, number 1949. In cases of unintentional murder, zihar, and other similar offenses, liberating a slave was regarded as their atonement and sadaqah. See Surah 4, verse 92, Surah 58, verse 3, and Surah 5, verse 89. It was directed to marry off slave men and slave women who were capable of marriage so that they could become equivalent in status, both morally and socially, to other members of the society. Reference Surah 24, verse 32. If a person were to marry a slave woman of someone, great care was exercised since this could result in a clash between ownership and conjugal rights. However, such people were told that if they did not have the means to marry free women, they could marry, with the permission of their masters, slave women who were Muslims and were also kept chaste. In such marriages, they must pay their dowers so that this could bring them gradually equal in status to free women. The Quran says, "And if any of you have not the means wherewith to wed free believing women, he may wed believing girls from among those whom you own. And Allah has full knowledge about your faith. You are of the same species. So wed them with the permission of their owners, and give them their dowers, according to the norms, with the condition that they should be kept chaste, neither being lustful nor taking paramours. This permission is for those among you who fear sin, but it is better for you that you practice self-restraint. And Allah is ever forgiving, most merciful." Surah 4, verse 25. In the heads of zakah, a specific head for freeing necks was instituted so that the campaign of slave emancipation could receive impetus from the public treasury. Reference Surah 9, verse 60. Fornication was regarded as an offense as a result of which prostitution centers that were operated by people on the basis of their slave women were shut down automatically, and if someone tried to go on secretly running this business, he was given exemplary punishment. People were told that they were all slaves of Allah, and so instead of using the words slave man and slave woman, the words used should be boy or man and girl or woman, so that the psyche about them should change, and a change is brought about in age-old concepts. Reference Muslim al-Jamil Sahih, page 998, numbers 5875 and 5877. A big source of the institution of slavery at the advent of the last Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was the prisoners of war. When such a situation arose for the Muslims, the Quran emphasized that they cannot be kept as slaves and must be kept as prisoners of war. After this, if they were to be released, then there were two possibilities. They could be freed either by accepting ransom or as a favor by not taking any ransom money. No other option was available to the Muslims.